I was going to buy a streaming box for a fleeting moment when I thought...
when you were becoming a vlogger, right?
Well, no, I'm still becoming a vlogger, just exceptionally slowly. But I thought about buying a streaming box when I thought I was going to get into like Switch streaming with iMic, and then never ended up doing so.
I wonder which of us makes our second YouTube video first, you or me?
It's a race to the bottom, I assure you. All right, let's start with some follow-up. Guess what? We don't really have any. I think that's because, in part, we just released, or Marco just released, last week's episode earlier today, because we are recording the episode from the future in the past or something, because it is currently the 20th of July. We are recording the episode that will be released on or around the 26th of July, because our vacations are in serial, and so we didn't really have time to amass follow-up. Other than to say, we are going to be doing a Q&A episode, I believe. What did you say, John, Master of Ceremonies, Syracuse? You said the 4th?
I think it's recording on August 4th, and we're doing a double recording with back-to-back episodes, which is why we're doing the Q&A, because we're just going to answer questions until we all die, and then Marco will make two shows out of it.
Sounds wonderful. So anyway, so yes, please pile up questions. At this time, the only way to get a question put in it to be a contender for the show is to tweet with the hashtag AskATP. Please do not email us, because it will get lost to the ether. And if we were cooler like Hello Internet, we would have asked for postcards, but we are not that cool nor that organized. So
tweet that would be a terrible mistake. Have we learned nothing from Hello Internet? who wants to go to the post office or PO box and bring home a bunch of pieces of paper and then transcribe the things on them? Terrible mistake.
Yeah, so please tweet hashtag AskATP, and we will hopefully select your question. Anyway, that's it for follow up, right? That might be record time. We should have somebody go through and chronicle how long we spend on follow up. Like, what does the trend line look like?
I'm sure there's like one angry fan who has already done that.
Is that fan you? Because no one else cares. It's fine. Sometimes there's none at all. Sometimes there's just one thing. Sometimes there's a lot. If we record 2 days before we do a second recording, usually not that much.
Funny how that works out.
You should go on Adobe scheduled vacations more often.
You're right. Oh, man. All right. So let's start with the topics. And first thing is the Apple A10X is 10 nanometer. That's cool. So tell us about this, John.
Remember we were talking about Intel and their process advantage and how Taiwan Semiconductor was supposedly catching up, but Intel still had a lead and all sorts of stuff. And we were going to see, you know, Intel was going to be first at 10 nanometer with a significant, you know, type of chip, not just memory or something like that. But as people who took apart the new iPad with the Apple's A10X in it discovered, the A10X system on a chip is using Taiwan Semiconductor's 10 nanometer process. And A10X is not a tiny chip. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not as big as a Xeon, but it's pretty complicated, right? It's got multiple cores and a GPU and I/O. It's not just as simple as a memory chip. So I haven't been keeping up with Intel and its various woes that much. But bottom line, you know, of all the Apple devices we care about, which includes PCs and iPads and watches and phones and all sorts of other things, the first one, as far as I'm aware, to get a 10 nanometer chip is this one, and the chip is not from Intel. So whether or not Intel has, quote unquote, lost its lead in process, it continues to be embarrassing that Apple's system on a chip, a XX line of chips, are so fast and so low power and now are on a smaller process than the chips that are in all of Apple's Macs. So it's kind of exciting / depressing, depending on how you look at it.
So remind me, and I'm not being funny at all, what is the 10 nanometer represent? The lines within the processor, like the quote unquote wires, is that correct? Or is that not even close?
Oh, I don't know. They call it feature size. I'm sure there's some standard for measuring from, you know, this thing to that thing. Like, okay. I think it was like a dot pitch on monitors. I'm sure there's some standard, because you can say, well, what is a feature? Like, it's from, you know, from one transistor to another, how closely you can pack them together, or like, I have no idea.
Maybe it's like the center of one to the center of the next one.
Yeah, but there's different geometries. Like, this is their FinFET thing. Like, they're actually 3D. If you look at the shape of where the source and drain and gate and everything is, they all have all these clever arrangements of layers of stuff. Someone should look up. You could probably just go to the Wikipedia and find out. But it basically, if you think of it like dot pitch on a monitor, it's from, you know, how from the center of, like Mark was saying, from the center of one thing to the center of the other. The question is, how do they determine that? Because I think there are different sizes and configuration of things that you can put down on a chip. I'm assuming it is like the smallest distance between two features. So anyway, Taiwan Semiconductor doing pretty well. Apple with its A series chips doing pretty well. Intel, I don't know, doing okay. Kind of stumbling. It was the recent announcement they were getting out of the wearables market that they were never really in.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do they have in the wearables market?
They had a program and an initiative and an attempt, like they've done many times. Like, remember when they tried to get into the standalone GPU market with what the hell was that called? Chat room will tell me in seconds or so.
Yeah, like about 5 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, where they were taking a bunch of little x86 cores and put them in Larrabee. I got it before the chat room. Haha. And they were going to make a run at the GPU market, and they had evangelists, and they had APIs, and they had some silicon, and it just never came together. And they said, oh, okay, well, we're not going to do that. And then they concentrated on their internal GPUs, like the integrated ones, and they've come a long way on that, partially, supposedly, a rumor has it, at the behest of Apple, asking for more powerful integrated GPU, so they don't have to include a discrete GPU on every single Mac just to have any graphics performance worth a damn. But they were going to get into wearables, and they had an initiative, and they had a team, and they had a blah blah blah, and now they've just bailed on it. They also had a bunch of things like getting into set top boxes back in the day. What it's like of all the Intel failed programs where they're going to enter a new market. I mean, if you want to trace it all the way backwards, it's when they divested of all their ARM holdings. They had, what was it, another thing, Xscale. They had ARM CPU, and they said, now we're going to get out of that business. Probably going to turn out to have been a bad idea, but in theory, like, it didn't have to be. It could have been they got out of that business and they made a bunch of their own x86 chips that were just as good as the things that Apple is making now, but they didn't make those and Apple did, and so that's how you lose. So you can trace it back to, oh, you should have stopped. There's no guarantee that if they had kept Xscale that they would have been able to do as good a job as Apple is doing now. So it's a weird world we live in for someone who grew up in the Wintel era, but I'm still rooting for Intel because all the CPUs are in all the Macs, and I want a really good Mac, so let's get going.
Yeah, that's pretty much why I care about this stuff so much. Like, I know that it's probably, for lots of reasons we've discussed before, it's probably unlikely that we're ever going to see, or at least, I guess never say never, but that anytime soon we're going to see Apple bring the A line of ARM CPUs to the Mac and have ARM Macs. And that's kind of a shame because these CPUs are awesome. Like, they keep making these amazing chips, and with their in-house designs that are kicking the butts of everything else in the mobile market. And Intel is really, you know, having a hard time getting incremental performance gains every time they release something, and they're even having a hard time releasing anything. So I kind of wish that more of this excitement would be available on the Mac side because, you know, who knows what they could do. Right now, they have this amazing A10X chip, based on the amazing A10 chip, making the iPad very competitive with low-end Macs in CPU performance. And imagine what they could do with that if they let it run in a 150-watt desktop enclosure. Like, that could be really amazing. But, you know, for lots of reasons we've discussed before, basically, like, you know, making ARM Macs is neither easy nor likely. But I do think that's kind of a shame because there's all this exciting stuff happening over in the ARM world that us Mac fans are just kind of, you know, not a part of or minimally a part of.
I continue to think that there is nothing specifically magical about ARM that guarantees that if Apple did have a team that said, hey, you've got 150-watt power budget, go nuts. They would just have to end up doing all the same things that Intel does with its Xeon. Only Intel probably has a bunch of them patented and Apple doesn't have experience with them because you do end up making different choices when you have a ridiculously high power budget like that. And there's no secret sauce that only Apple knows. And a lot of the tricks they know from their experience with low power stuff are not applicable to 150-watt power envelope. So, you know, I think they would make good chips, no doubt. And maybe they would make ones that are actually better than what Intel offers. But it's not I don't feel like they would be crushing them in the same way that they're crushing on the low power side, because this is not Apple's first chip. Like, you know, what was it? The A6 was their first, you know, sort of their own design.
Yeah.
They've had years and years to get this good at system on a chips in tablets and phones. They have no experience so far on making, you know, a Xeon class processor. So even if they did make one, the best you could hope for is probably like parity or a slight edge on Intel's things, because they can make different choices. But give them 4 or 5 years, and I think they'd be doing really well. But who knows? Then we wouldn't be able to run Windows as well as we can now, so that would be sad.
Who runs Windows anymore? What year is this?
I do. Casey does.
I used to. Just, no, I don't. No, I don't anymore. I used to.
Yeah, Casey's, no. Casey's a real developer now.
Ooh, sick burn. But yay!
Yeah, my apologies to everyone who has to develop on Windows. I feel bad for you.
Hey, man, I maintain C# is an unbelievably good language. It's just everything around it that's garbage.
I agree. I completely agree. Yeah, and Microsoft has almost always been really good at developer tooling. Like, they're really good at that. Just Windows is terrible. but the developer tools are usually great. But yeah. And there, you know, one thing before we cap off this topic is that I do think that, you know, even though my example of, you know, the 150-watt Mac Pro / you know, high-end iMac chip would maybe be hard for them to move to, the A10X, you know, the iPad class of chip that they're making now, which is not that different from the iPhone class chip they're making, is probably suitable for at least the bottom two lines of MacBooks, at least the MacBook 12-inch and at least the what I call the MacBook Escape, the non-touch bar 13-inch MacBook Pro. I bet they could make an A-series chip that would be very competitive in those two form factors.
Yeah, I mean, they already do, practically.
You know? Yeah, exactly. It's
just a question of the GPU. And by the way, it's making me think about things about Mac losing out. Like, oh, so they're missing out on Apple's, on the potential of Apple's expertise in the areas where they've been shown they can make a really good chip, and their potential expertise for higher bandwidth chips. And also, Apple thus far is missing out on the other place that the action is happening that's relevant to the Mac in terms of silicon chips that are inside there, NVIDIA GPUs. That is currently where a lot of the exciting high-end action is happening on desktop computers, and Apple is thus far pretending it doesn't exist and continuing to ship AMD/ATI GPUs, which are fine, but it's not, you know, it's like the excitement is happening on the ARM side with Apple's own things, and in the GPU land, the discrete GPU land, the excitement is happening on NVIDIA's side of the fence, and Apple is like, no, we're just going to Intel and AMD, and we'll just ignore all those fireworks and the happy laughter happening in other areas.
Yeah, and I do think ultimately one of the biggest reasons why we're unlikely to see ARM Max for the foreseeable future is I really don't think that a lot of Mac apps would be rewritten or recompiled for ARM in a prompt manner. Like, I think the Mac is, you know, some parts of the Mac are very healthy, you know, content creation, you know, pro high-end productivity tools, these are fairly healthy, but there's a whole lot of Mac apps out there that are basically unmaintained, and some of which are very, very old. And they continue to work now just because, you know, the architecture hasn't changed in a long time, you know, in over 10 years. And so they continue to work, but I worry if Apple were to force an incompatible move to the basis of the operating system, I worry about what would happen to the app ecosystem. I bet we'd lose a lot of apps, as we're seeing right now. iOS is, in this way, iOS is way healthier than Mac OS, and the transition to Mac to iOS 11 is losing lots of apps just from the 64-bit change. It was only a few years ago for the Mac to change CPU architectures. It would be I think really difficult to move a lot of Mac software over, just because so much of it's unmaintained.
Numerically, iOS obviously will lose more because it's numerically got so much more. But on the Mac, I have some confidence. You know, the Mac has gone through this multiple times before in the past, that yes, you always leave stuff behind, but the apps that we care about would be ported, just like they were ported from 68K to PowerPC, and those same apps that we care about that were still ARM ported from PowerPC to Intel, and they were ported from Intel 32-bit to 64-bit, and they would be ported from 64-bit. Like, the apps we care about would be ported. It's just maybe like one or two random abandoned apps that you would lose. But numerically speaking, on iOS, there's just so many apps, and we all have some. I think, I don't know, do you think you have more apps installed on cumulatively on your iOS devices or on your Macs? Like, numerically, each application icon counts as one thing.
Oh, it's no question, iOS.
I would guess the same Yeah, probably. Maybe not on my iPad. On my iPhone, yes. I think my iPad is relatively lean and mean, but iPhone, yeah, I think Marco's right.
How many applications are in your applications folder on your Mac? Just pick a random Mac.
I have 129.
112.
Although many of these I barely even recognize because I long show infrequently.
Yeah, I know. We all have junk in there. Oh, this is reassuring. So in my applications folder, I have two applications called System Preferences, which apparently have exactly the same name.
That's good.
This does not make me feel good. This is from 2014. And the second one is from 2015 and 2016. And one of them does not have a .app extension. That makes me feel good.
I got to clear a lot of this crap out of here. My God.
Anyway, you want to guess how many applications I have in my application folder?
I mean, if I have 129 and I keep things pretty minimal, I'm going to guess you have 200 maybe?
Yeah, I'm going to say 250-ish. Is it Price is Right rules?
No.
Oh, okay. Then I don't have to bet one application.
Yeah. 311.
Oof.
Wow.
Goodness.
Do you, but like, how many do you actually use on a regular basis?
Not 311.
Like, I probably use something like 20 or 30 on a regular basis. I mean, you know, the Mac tools tend to be larger in scope and fewer in number for a lot of people, I would bet. You know, there's a lot more like large productivity tools, large creation tools, large library tools, as opposed to an iOS where you have a whole bunch of stuff that does like little things or one thing at a time. Not to mention iOS has games and the Mac unfortunately doesn't.
I do have a subfolder for games. Let's see what's in that.
I have a subfolder for Mac ports that I haven't touched.
I mean I have a Steam icon there too. All right. So the games folder only have 42 items, but there are subfolders in there. So it just goes on and on and on. I got a lot of applications. Here's the thing, the reason I have so many applications is they don't, on the Mac, applications aren't in your face like they are in iOS. Like in Springboard, they're in your face unless you bury them in a folder. Like all of them are. Like, and I don't launch applications by going to the application folder. Like nobody does. You do Command Space or whatever, right?
Yeah, of course.
And whenever I use like Disk Inventory X or whatever to find out where all my space is being taken up, it's never with applications because in the grand scheme of things, they're tiny. You know, my 1 terabyte drive, even a huge application, like maybe occasionally, like Marco, I get cranky at some multi-gigabyte sound samples that are part of some stupid Apple application. But other than that, all the data is elsewhere. So I never ended up deleting applications. Like I look in here and I've got like, I don't know, I got multiple old, I've got Delicious Library 2 and 3. I've got many applications where they're like, the history of the application is present in the folder as the versions and the numbers and the icons go up. And
yep.
I never end up deleting them because it's not as, and don't get me wrong, my iOS home screens are also a giant graveyard of ancient files, which is why I'm kind of dreading when they drop 32-bit support because it's going to, well, dreading and looking forward to because it'll like reduce the number of applications by half because I think I still have applications there from like my original iPod Touch that have just been carrying along from iTunes backup to iTunes backup.
I only had, I think, two. Yeah, I have Scorekeeper XL and iCast Pro. And the Scorekeeper developer said he's updating it. iCast has already done a new version that's like $1 million, so you know they're not actually really going to be lost.
Is iCast the thing you use to do the live broadcast from the road?
I used to, yes. It's an iCast server, or an iCast broadcaster, rather. So I used to do that from the road. Now I just bring a Mac and use Rogamiba's NiceCast app because it's what I learned, you know, while doing our live show and, you know, setting up for that and doing various things over the last few years, I've learned basically that I greatly prefer Macs to be in those kind of production roles, and not just for like superstition of Macs being reliable and iPad and iOS not being, but just for the flexibility they offer. And the, like, you can do these things on iOS if you need to, but I'm much happier and more versatile when I'm doing it on the Mac, if that makes sense.
I mean, we all know that you can't get work done on iOS, so that's why you're doing it on a Mac.
Oh my God, I still have Firefox? Wow. Does anybody still use Firefox?
So we've gone during the pre-show that hopefully has not hit the regular show of watching TV as a group, and now we're letting all the people listen to us plunge through and go spelunking through our application folders as a group. This is the best.
I still have Make MKV. I haven't ripped a Blu-ray in years.
I just did that yesterday.
I have Firefox. I also have Make MKV.
Yeah, I ripped Days of Thunder yesterday. It's a great movie.
See, I don't need to rip anything. I can just play stuff off of your Plex server.
I know. That's exactly what I was doing. We bought Days of Thunder on Blu-ray, but Blu-rays are barbaric, and so I immediately ripped it, and it is now on Plex.
Oh, I still have open TTD. I should play that. The Transport Tycoon.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
I have applications with like the circle with a line through it. I should just probably delete those.
I don't think I've ever even seen that.
Do not run on my fancy new version of Mac OS called El Capitan.
Man, I can't even imagine cleaning out John's 10-year-old computer like that. What you must find there.
Just never clean it. That's the secret.
We are sponsored this week by Fracture, a photo printing company that prints photos directly onto glass. Visit fractureme.com/podcast for 10% off your first order. Fracture is a photo decor company that's out to rescue your images from the digital ether. They know if you just post a picture to Facebook or whatever, it's gone off people's timelines in, what, a day at most, and you never see it again. Fracture wants you to take those favorite pictures and get them printed and hang them in your house or give them to people as gifts. They make wonderful gifts for any occasion, for family and friends, and they really make your house look lived in, and they show your memories to you and everyone who comes over. We have these all over our house. They get tons of compliments. It's nice to get photos printed once in a while. It really is, and Fracture is the best and easiest way to do that. And these are printed on glass, so it goes edge to edge. The colors look great. They really pop. The contrast really pops. And it just looks sleek and it looks modern. You don't have to get them framed because they are their own independent object. It's wonderful. They have a laser cut rigid backing. So the whole thing isn't glass front to back, because that would be really heavy and fragile. It's glass in the front and there's rigid backing on the back. So it's very lightweight and easy to hang. They even include a wall anchor right in the box. It's so easy to get these things. All you have to do is upload a picture and pick your size. That's it. So you can bring a special memory to life with these prints, give them as unique gifts, or decorate your home with the moments that tell your story. Every Fracture print comes with a 60-day happiness guarantee, so you're sure to love your order. And they're all handmade in Gainesville, Florida, from U.S. source materials in a carbon-neutral factory. For more information and 10% off your first order, visit fractureme.com/podcast. The Last You Wish podcast sent you, tell them ATP, and that'll help support the show. So thank you very much to Fracture for sponsoring our show once again.
So in the show notes, near-ish the top, but never, ever, ever high enough for us to actually talk about it, has been three words, and it has been here 4 months. And those three words are Netflix credits skipping. And apparently this is enough, and John is flustered enough that he would like to talk to us about skipping credits in Netflix. I don't know why. I'm in for this ride as much as you guys are. So let's all buckle up together.
Oh, we are really scraping the bottom of the barrel here.
We really are.
You know why this is in there. I mean, the link there explains it. So this is from March. So yes, it has been there for many, many months. The story, we'll link to The Verge thing, because by now it's the only URL we have for the story, is that Netflix, in their normal way, was like testing this new feature on some platforms and some clients for Netflix, that when you're watching a show on Netflix and the credits come on, the opening credits to the show, like there would be a button in the interface somewhere that says skip credits, and you click that, it would skip it.
When we were in Chicago, we were finishing up House of Cards, and I had done that by connecting my MacBook Adorable to the TV, and I saw and used that button, and so that was on the web client.
Yeah, and I'm not sure where they're rolling it out to and what clients or whatever, but it's not everywhere, and it seems like it's a thing they're testing. Now, already for several years, Netflix has had a thing where if you're like binge-watching and you watch one episode and the next episode's going to come, that it will not show the credits to the subsequent episode, so it'll just get right to the program. I've seen that. I don't know if that show specific or whatever, but it's been doing that for a long time. So if you sit down and watch 5 episodes of a program, you don't have to see the opening credits 5 times, but you would have to see it once for the first one. And now with the skip credits thing, it'll be like, if you don't want to see the opening credits to House of Cards because you're afraid you'll die of old age, you can, and you're on the right interface, you can click this button to skip it. And the reason I put this in the notes so long ago is that 4 years before this feature was added to Netflix, mm-hmm. I, in one of my rare fits of blogging, wrote a blog post about this very thing, about the idea of credit skipping in Netflix-type environments specifically. It was also in the context of the PlayStation 4, which was not yet out, but had been announced, and the features had been announced. And the title of this post is, annoyance-driven development, the idea that if you look at technology product or something that you're working on and think about the things that annoy you and other people about your product and try to knock those down one by one, even if they seem silly. I think, refreshing my memory on this thing, the PlayStation examples were things like being able to pick up a game right where you left off and not having the thing start downloading a software update as soon as you turn it on. And so they did a lot of things in the PlayStation 4 to remove the annoyances of the PlayStation 3 by giving it a low power mode and an auxiliary processor that let it do useful things when it's quote-unquote off. Like, the fans are off, it's sitting there, you think it's completely off, but it's not. It's downloading software updates in the background. It's, you know, it's preserving the state of your game so you can pick up right where you left off. Even Nintendo has come on this bandwagon a little bit with the Switch, where you can put the thing into sleep mode, pick it up, get it out of sleep mode, and you are exactly at the second you left off in your Zelda game. Which makes you want to pick it up and play more than if you had to like wait through a boot sequence or launch the game again or something like that. And software updates, which are ubiquitous nowadays, having it download multiple gigabytes of stuff while you sleep so that when you wake up, it's all just already there for you, is a great example of annoyance-driven development, because it's not the end of the world. Like, oh, software updates have to happen, and there's no getting around the fact that you've got to have multiple gigabytes and we can't make your internet connection faster. It's like, but can we design the PlayStation 4 in a way to make this less annoying for people? Going so far as to have a separate mode with a separate CPU and a low power state of like it complicates the hardware tremendously, but it's a big win. So in terms of streaming video, I was using House of Cards as an example because the credit sequence is really, really long. I was saying how Netflix has changed how you watch television, how you have to reconsider every part of the experience and think about how annoying it is. And the opening credits aren't annoying in the old world of television, where there were no DVRs and you just watched television when it was on and that was it. Commercials were annoying, but that's a whole separate issue. But already with Netflix and streaming video, they understand that people do binge watching, and they did that thing where it will skip the credits to the next episode. They just need to go to the next step. Also, by the way, releasing entire seasons all at once instead of doling them out an episode at a time. They reconsidered so many things, and this seemed like the very next thing on the chopping block, which is, hey, credits, they make sense when you are watching television in the old world. In the new world, do they make as much sense to have opening credits before every single episode or before any episode? And I know, as I said in this post, there's lots of things about union contracts for screen actors and writers and everything. And then there's the other angle of it, like, oh, people should get credit for their work and blah, blah, blah. Like, basically the motivation behind all those union rules and everything. But I think you have to change your outlook and the rules surrounding all this stuff as the technology changes. And technology is changing how we watch television. And so every single aspect of how we watch television should be up for grabs for reconsideration to say, is this the best way to do it? Or is there a better way given how technology has changed how we watch television? And apparently Netflix eventually, how many years later? 4 years later, eventually more or less agrees with me that maybe the credits are a little bit too much and maybe we should give people the option of skipping them entirely if they want. There's already no commercials, so they've already got that going for them. So anyway, I was excited enough about this in March to put it in the show notes and to leave it there. And now I finally get to talk about it. And I feel like this is, I'm not going to say it's vindication because I know a lot of people agreed with me when I originally posted this, but it's more of a celebration to say, you know, I'm actually getting the thing that I was asking for. And it seemed inevitable because Netflix is very aggressive in these type of things. I'm actually surprised it took 4 years for them to do it, but more like this, please.
Wow.
Cool.
I feel better for having listened to that. Nothing you said was wrong, but I felt like this had been sitting in the show notes, like almost there, but not quite there for months. And I was expecting some sort of revelation.
It's not timely. It's not like, you know, it doesn't go bad.
John, I love right? you so much.
And, you know, you don't have a product to speak of now what did Dr. Wave say your application was? Was it a fart app?
Oh, yes. I was so confused.
It looks kind of like a guy farting. I don't know. Anyway, Marco's got a product. Yeah. But anybody who's listening to this who has a product or is involved in making a thing that people use, like it's a potential edge in the market. Think about what is annoying about using products of your type, and in the next version of your product, try to eliminate those annoyances and don't keep any sacred cows. Like, oh, well, we can't change that. Like you'll find a lot of people hold sacred many things they won't even consider changing. Like, you have to consider everything and reconsider it in the face of technology and find the annoying things and be willing to, you know, do what Sony did, make your product way more complicated and way more expensive, potentially introducing bugs, because the payoff is when people turn on the PlayStation 4, the 11 gigabytes of the Destiny 2 beta is already downloaded and the system update has already happened and they can start playing immediately. Even if it takes forever to download, if it does it while you're sleeping, you don't care. And it's 100% worth it to add an entire separate CPU and low power state and special OS mode for this. So, and also skip those House of Cards credits, because come on, we've all seen them enough now.
So, I mean, they're beautiful, but they're so long. Oh my word, it takes forever.
So long, so long.
All right, so let's talk about something that always cheers us up. Twitter! And a while back, there was, God, I don't even remember when this
how,
was.
How long was it? How long was a while ago, Casey?
Apparently, it was October of 2016.
Why are we talking about a news article from October 2016?
I have a reason for this one, too.
Oh, my God.
Bringing out your dead. That's right.
I'm so sorry, listeners, for this entire episode.
You apologize here. Where do episodes come from, Marco? When three podcasters love each other very much, somehow every week there's an episode, and it's because some elves go into the show notes and find a bunch of topics and put them in there. And if you're not going to do it, guess what? I'm going to do it. And then you don't get to complain about the things that we talk about and try to apologize for the listeners for the things we're talking about. Because guess what? I build the show in the notes, and that's what we're going to talk about. And if you want to talk about something, feel free to rotate something up to the top, and then we'll talk about that instead. In fact, I will offer that opportunity to you now, because I just talked about Netflix credit skipping. Is there something that you would like to talk about that you would like to move up?
Let me see.
Overcast Springboard Crasher stories? That's a good one.
It's kind of boring.
It's not.
I think it's exciting.
It's exciting.
When it happened, but now I've forgotten most about it, and probably you did too, but it was cool.
Well, and it's not even old. It's not even old by comparison to October of 2016.
It was like a couple of months ago.
In a surprising turn of events, Marco did not immediately Command-A and then delete the entire show notes in a fit of rage when just moments ago.
The secret is he doesn't look at them most of the time, so that's...
That is accurate.
If we scroll down a couple pages, we have an item that says...
Oh, God.
TSMC ahead of Intel on process soon? Question mark.
Look at that, the show notes. they're like a crystal ball.
But look at the slug on this. 10-nanometer chip foundry process coming to Apple partner TSMC ahead of Intel.
And it was from that ever-reliable news source, AppleInsider.com.
Yeah,
it's dated September of 16. Oh, my word.
We didn't talk about it, but guess what? They did it.
It came true. So maybe this is how we can make things come true. Just put them in our show notes.
Put them in the show notes, and it's like burying a time capsule.
It's like our show notes are the crock pot of Apple News. Just wait long enough. It's going to be there. Oh, my God. All right. So let's talk about Disney, since Marco hasn't come up with something better. But it'll be the Marco show after this when we talk about Overcast and Springboard.
Marco should start remembering now all the details of the Springboard Crasher stuff.
Did you know that Letterpress moved off of Game Center?
I did know that.
That's down here, too.
We should do, if we get really desperate, we should go from the bottom up and just say we're dedicated. We have to do it. Just start at the bottom. Oh my word. This is so bad. Anyway, all right, I'm going to try to bring this back around. So at some point one day eventually, or years ago it seems, there was some talk in late 2016 about Twitter potentially looking to be bought. And there were some potential suitors. I don't remember who they were other than Disney.
Wasn't Salesforce in the running?
Maybe. And so what ended up happening, and I didn't get a chance to look at these show notes and refresh my memory. So being chief summarizer in chief is a little dangerous today. But my recollection is that Disney was kind of sniffing around, seeing, maybe we do want Twitter, and then realized, oh, wait, Twitter's a cesspool of disgusting, terrible people. We don't want anything to do with that.
Well, the reason I put this in there, not because I don't care about this, whatever, people buying Disney, that's old news. And I don't know why it stayed in the notes. I probably would have deleted it. But I saw it down there, and it brought to mind something. What was it? It was relevant. It's eternally relevant. I forget what the specific inciting incident was. But it's about when you have an online community of any kind. I know what it was. It was the PUBG thing. You guys don't follow this. Do you know what that is?
Nope.
Anyways, it's a new game, Player Unknown Battleground. It's a game. It's a cool game. You'll like the premise of it.
We love games.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a game mode. I think it might have started as a mod, and now it's a zone game. I'd always get confused about the details. But anyway, you are like an army guy. You parachute into this, you know, fairly realistic looking world, like a big open field with some trees and buildings and stuff like that. And you have to sort of scrounge for weapons and bandages and stuff like that. And it's fairly realistic in that you can't take 500 bullets, like a few bullets kills you, right? And there are teams, and there's sort of a gamey, shimmery circle, ring, dome around the entire play area that starts off really, really big, but it slowly shrinks over time, eventually like corralling all the people together, and eventually there's one person who's left alive, right? So part your strategy could be, I'm just going to crawl in the grass and hide behind this tree and be like a mile away from everybody, but the circle will shrink and shrink and shrink, and if you're not out there fighting, you're also not getting better weapons and getting healing supplies and stuff like that. So it's a fun game mode. And they're fun videos to watch because there are teams and there's friendly fire and it's and there's no like radar or anything like that. You're just like crawling around and going through buildings and some people like camp out in buildings and you just go around a door and there's a guy. Anyway, it's a very popular game right now. And the guy who made the game has like a, you know, community standards for, you know, for his game, basically saying if you intentionally kill people on your team because friendly fire is a thing, that's against the rules and you get banned, you know, temporarily banned. And I assume if you keep doing it, permanently banned. Because that's bad behavior. We don't want someone who comes and you join a game and the guy on your team kills everybody on his own team and takes their stuff. Like, no, we won't have that, right? And he did that to, like, a popular streamer, like a Twitch streamer. And the Twitch streamer was cranky about it and said some jokey things to him about, like, how he was going to kick him in the face or something like that. And the guy, because he had temporarily banned him, and he explained to him why he doesn't tolerate even jokey sort of threats of violence or whatever. And anyway, that was the story, like, game creator bans popular streamer and has to explain to him why he doesn't think threats of violence are funny, you know, counter to everything in macho, stupid gamer dude culture, right? And it made me think of Twitter and anybody who has any kind of community, whether it's the game that you made and the standards you make for the people who play your game online, or Twitter, who makes a service that they let people use, or, you know, just think of anything, like if you have a website, and you have comment section, or you have the old style web bulletin boards, or whatever. Online communities and the policing of them. It always amazes me, that, or Reddit is a great example, it always amazes me how reluctant people are in these communities to enforce any kind of, to enforce their will. Like, so we all have opinions about what we think is good and what's not good, but the standard sort of non-oppressed majority opinion of like, I'm not in a group that is frequently the target of abuse, or I'm at the top of the pyramid, therefore I think everyone should be able to do everything. So even though I think something is bad, I'm not going to tell people in my community that they can't do that thing, because who am I to judge, right? And I, you know, even if removing the motivation, just the whole idea of like, I want my community to be a place where everyone is free to be themselves and do whatever the heck they want. And it almost seems to me at various times on Twitter and other places that there is, you know, there is nothing so terrible that the community, the people who run the community would decide that it's not allowed, right? So it's like, I'm trying to think of something for the show that I could use as an example. Like, you know, if someone comes in and says, I'm in favor of eating babies. I love to eat babies. They come out and I just eat them instantly, right? Perfectly healthy babies, I eat them, right? And people are like, you know, we don't like baby eating. Can you ban all the people who promote baby eating in this community? Because they're really annoying and we're all against it, right? Like everyone here in this community of, you know, knitters or woodworking people or, you know, go-kart enthusiasts or whatever. Can we just say that if you promote the eating of babies, you get banned? Like no baby eaters, right? And the people who run the community would be like, well, I don't like eating babies. And I know most people don't like it, but those people should have the right to talk about baby eating. And it's like, what do you mean the right? It's your community. It's a website that you made. It's a product that you made. It's not, you're not the U.S. government. They can talk about eating babies all they want on their front lawn. I don't want them in this community. And so they decide to make a community where everyone is allowed to do everything. Because that feels like egalitarian for them, and, you know, it's freedom. And even if they don't invoke freedom of speech, it's like, this is the kind of community we want. We want a community where everyone feels free to say anything they want, even if it's about baby eating. And there's a place for that type of thing. I think you usually call that place 4chan, right? But whatever. Right? But it continues to be amazing to me that you see so little of the other thing where they say, you know what? This is my community and I don't like baby eating. And if you talk about baby eating here, you're banned forever. And they're like, that's not fair. Just because you don't like, just because I don't like baby eating. That's the only reason. And this is my community, right? Whether it's this guy with his gamer. And that's why you get a situation where this person saying, hey, killing people on your team is bad and threats of violence on Twitter are bad and you're going to get banned for it. That's why it's a story. Like, that's a story in the gaming news. It's a man bites dog story, right? Like, whoa, someone decided, like, their own personal opinion, and they enforced their own personal opinion on their community. Is this person the worst person ever enforcing their own personal opinion? Now, in Twitter, there's no personal opinion, right? Because Twitter is a giant, massive corporation, but they have the same problem, that they seem unable to choose to enforce, you know, any kind of standards, because, like, well, we don't want to enforce our standards on other people. I use baby eating because I was hoping to find something that everyone in our audience would be like, yeah, I'm against baby eating. Now, the pro baby eating people, go ahead and email us, whatever. But now I'm going to say one that I would have used years ago in place of baby eating, feeling confident that everyone who's listening to my voice would be like, yeah, totally, baby eating is bad. But unfortunately, I cannot think that these days. And that is the example from Twitter, where Twitter is like, hey, are you the neo-Nazi party? You want to promote a Nazi agenda? You're fine on Twitter. As long as you don't, you know, threaten violence or blah, 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 or violate one of our things that we decide, we're okay with Nazis. Like, if they just want to talk peacefully about Nazi stuff, that's fine with us, as long as they don't threaten violence, right?
Wait, isn't, like, all of their speech kind of...
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I would just hope that Twitter, as a company, would be like, you know what? Even if Nazis are just, like, talking calmly about, you know, their Nazi agenda, no Nazis. Like, not like, are you in a group? Are you in the neo-Nazis? Are you in an organization, right? Are you affiliated with them? Do you promote that in any way? You're banned. It's like, whoa, you can't ban them. That's freedom. It's like, no, they can have their meetings. Like, they can talk about their Nazi things. They just can't be on Twitter. But Twitter seemingly cannot bring itself to do that, because it would be seen as like, oh, Twitter, don't go there, because they don't let you, if they don't like what they're saying, they ban you, right? And not just like, you know, things that we all agree are bad, but just like political ideas, like the Nazi party. Like, some people are just into that, man. Why can't you just, it's like, can't we just say no? And Twitter and many other companies' inability to draw the line, you know, and draw whatever Twitter wants to draw. Like, I feel like, you know, you lose all the Nazi people. Yeah, the Nazi people will go elsewhere. They'll have to go someplace else. Like, well, but if I ban too many things, everyone will leave and our daily active users will go. It's like, you have to make that choice. I feel confident, if I was running Twitter, that if we ban all the Nazis, just on principle, like, they don't have to do anything bad, they're just gone, right? That you won't lose too many users. And the users you do lose, it's good that you're losing them, right? And so it frustrates me as a user of Twitter and many other services to see the unwillingness to enforce, you know, personal standards. And even when, you know, if more people did this, that would mean people are going to have weird personal standards. They're going to be like, sorry, nobody's name begins with the letter J, and then I can't join their service and I would be mad about it, right? But it's their service. Like, they can make up their own stupid rules, right? I'm just saying, like, maybe the baby eaters and the Nazis, maybe get rid of them. And it's like, well, who cares? Twitter is being more successful if they let everybody in. But things like these rumors about, oh, someone was going to buy you, but your service is a cesspool, that, you know, your choices have a material effect on your company, not just on the users, which you should care about. Like, what's it like to use Twitter? The decisions about what is and isn't allowed affect what it's like to use Twitter. They also affect potentially who's willing to buy you, right? And they affect your image. Like, there's tangible and intangible repercussions to this. So I continue to hope that more services will act like small services with one opinionated person, like the guy who runs the, you know, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, to say, I have rules and these are my rules and you might not like the rules. That's my damn game. You don't like the rules, go somewhere else, make your own game, right? You don't like the rules on Twitter? Nazis, we're banning you all from Twitter. Go make your own service. Go someplace else. Go do another thing. Because we're not the U.S. government. So anyway, I'm against baby eating. I'm against Nazis. I'm also against player killing in Battleground.
How do you feel about people whose names begin with J?
Neutral. A lot of people whose names begin with J. Come on.
We are sponsored this week by Eero. Go to Eero.com and use code ATP for free overnight shipping. Eero is distributed Wi-Fi made easy for you at home. The single router model just does not work to cover houses well enough. We all know that you buy a router covered in antennas, and it says it's going to cover your whole house, and it still doesn't. What you need is a distributed Wi-Fi system. That's what offices and businesses have used for years. With Eero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your house in just a few minutes. All you got to do is download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it walks you through every step of the process. It's quick, easy, and very painless. Because current Wi-Fi routers are really, really hard to manage and to optimize. The Eero app does all this for you right in the palm of your hand. You can see how many devices are connected at any given point. You can see your internet speed. It tests it for you. It does QoS for you. You can do a guest network if you want. It's full of advanced features, but all exposed through a very, very easy-to-use app. And it's all protected with state-of-the-art encryption. And Eero also has incredible customer support if you need it. They've really invested heavily in this. You can call and you can get a hold of a Wi-Fi expert within 30 seconds. If you have any concerns about any devices during setup, one of their experts can walk you through everything. They can even help if you just want to know how many you should buy for your house. Just give them a call. I've tried Eero and it's wonderful. I could not believe how easy it was to set up. It literally took minutes to set up, and the app is truly wonderful. And they just released their second generation product. So second generation Eero's now, they have an additional 5 gigahertz radio, so they have even better coverage. It's now tri-band. It's twice as fast as its predecessor. It includes a new Thread radio for certain low-power devices, such as locks and doorbells and sensors. And the new Eero Beacon, which is the new like separate type of just a repeater unit that they have, is even half the size now. So it's even small. These things were already small and discreet before, and they looked beautiful pretty much anywhere in your house. And now the additional one is even smaller. It plugs directly into any wall outlet. It looks kind of like a nightlight. It's really small. It even has a nightlight built into it because they realize, well, we're here. Might as well do that too. It's pretty great. So check out Eero today. Once again, if you go to Eero.com to learn more, that's Eero.com, use promo code ATP at checkout for free overnight shipping. Once again, Eero.com, Eero.com, and use promo code ATP for free overnight shipping. Thank you very much to Eero for sponsoring the show once again.
Marco, you had some very interesting overcast crashes that you had a little bit of trouble figuring out, and justifiably, because having heard this story back a couple of months ago when you did discover what this fix was, I thought to myself, my goodness, I don't know if I would have ever been able to figure this out. But I think it's a really interesting, to the best of your recollection, story of both what was going on, why it was going on, and how you discovered it. So can you take us through this, maybe starting with, like, how did you discover there was an issue in the first place?
iTunes Connect, the backend for the App Store, reports your number of crashes for each version of your app. And this is as reported by people who opt in to sharing the stats with Apple and developers during the iPhone setup process. I started seeing a big uptick in crashes, and I started noticing a separate problem too, which is my app would crash in the background a lot, and I would get all these crash logs for background crashes. I didn't immediately identify it as such. What I immediately saw was my app would not resume playback if you hadn't been running it in a while. So like if you sent a play command, like let's say you get in your car and the Bluetooth turns on and it sends a play command, or you put on Bluetooth headphones and you hit the play button on them, I noticed that the app was not in memory anymore. I started getting reports that were auto-generated from Spring Board that it was terminating me in the background for holding on to a shared lock on the database file. So I did a number of things to try to fix this. I had read somewhere that if you open up a background task assertion, so in I forget how if the Mac does this, but if the on iOS you do the UI background task ID and you say begin background task with identifier, and it basically gives you a little handle, and you do your task, and then you tell it, okay, I finished that, end this task. And then if your app is about to be terminated for whatever reason and you have one of these open, the system will give you a little bit of extra time to go complete that. So somewhere I read some article that was, that I can't find now, which is probably good to protect the not so innocent. But somewhere I read some article that said, in order to fix these crashes about holding on to the lock too long, just open up a background task for every database query that you make. Because the way SQLite works is every query, it temporarily locks the database file, does what it needs to do, and then unlocks it. And this is required because that's how you have different processes sharing a file, or rather sharing a database through SQLite without some kind of server managing the background. Like you know, MySQL would have a server, but SQLite doesn't. So anyway, so it needs to do file locking to do this stuff. So I you know, got this tip from some random blog post that, oh, wrap every database query in a background task assertion, and then you won't have this problem anymore. That was technically true in the sense that...
Oh, here we go.
When I shipped the version that included this fix, it was technically true that I was no longer getting killed with that background code. However, what was happening is I noticed that my crash rate, rather than going down, went way, way up. It took me a while to figure out what was going on. And during the time that I was trying to figure out what was going on, I also noticed that as I would be listening to Overcast, like in the car on long car trips, sometimes my entire iPhone would crash. And it would do what nerds might know as a respring, which is that the phone does not reboot, but it looks like it's rebooting. And it just comes back up faster. And what, so you see the little spinner, all your apps quit, and then eventually you get back to your lock screen. And the way you can tell that it wasn't a real reboot is if Touch ID is still on. Because, you know, when you reboot for real, you have to enter your passcode the first time. But if it does a little spinner and back to the lock screen and all your apps are gone and Touch ID works, that was a springboard crash, not a full reboot. And I noticed my phone was doing this more and more. And it was very inconvenient at times, such as when I was driving and following directions in Waze. And my directions were just gone for a little while all the apps got killed and I had to restart everything. But anyway... And I started getting reports from people saying, my phone keeps crashing with Overcast, but I can't figure out why. And it took until one guy sent me a video that he showed something amazingly useful to me. He said, look, Overcast, if you pause it in the background and you bring up Control Center, so you can see like that Overcast is still in the now playing thing in Control Center, after 10 minutes exactly... Or no, I think it was like 3 minutes. Anyway, after some short duration of minutes, it disappears reliably every time. So that led me to finally catch it in a debugger and to see that I was being killed with a certain crash with a certain code. Now, this still was not enough to actually figure it out because the code I was getting killed with was, you've exceeded some limit. And it's like, okay, well, helpful, maybe, you know, thanks. But, you know, I have no idea still. And I tried a few things trying to figure out what limit am I exceeding here? What does this code mean? Eventually, I realized that this would also sometimes correspond with one of those springboard crashes where the whole phone would crash. And so I thought, I wonder if this is related. I direct messaged somebody who I know on the springboard team. I basically said, look, I'm at my wit's end here. I can't figure this out. Is there anything that would cause this crash code to be sent to my app that might sometimes crash Springboard? A little while later, I hear, oh, there's actually like a bug report internal to Apple talking about how Overcast is causing this problem. I was like,
nice.
Oh,
do you think they ever would have told you? Or they're just like,
I don't. So what? There is actually there is like a process that happens sometimes inside of Apple where if you have an app that's causing lots of problems for Apple, like sometimes you will hear from one of the developer evangelists about it. This has happened to me maybe like once or twice ever. So this isn't a thing that happens often, but this was happening in the lead up to WWDC. This is only a couple weeks before WWDC, I think, if I remember correctly. And so the problem with that is that this is a time when the entire, like all of Apple is basically freaking out, rushing to finish the WWDC betas. Because that's like the first time the OS is really going to see any kind of wide attention. It's going to be installed on a bunch of developer devices and a bunch of enthusiasts who say they're developers who aren't and just use the developer betas anyway. So there's a massive rush right before WWDC for anybody who works in anything near these new OSs to just get it done, get that first beta ready for the public. And so this was happening during that big crunch time, so I imagine it slipped through the cracks. You know, I'm sure it was on somebody's to-do list to maybe see if they could reach out to me or something, and they didn't. Because you can imagine Apple is not so keen on an app that can crash Springboard. Like, that's not something that apps are supposed to be able to do. So there was this internal thing that I just happened to, like, I happened to ask somebody who started looking around who happened to find this. And then the notes that Apple engineering had noticed about it was that I was taking a large number of background assertions in the app, which was apparently causing Springboard has like a watchdog that goes along and checks various limits every few minutes. And that watchdog, when it looked at how many background assertions I had, because I was doing one for every database query, so like, you know, a typical load of the app is going to make probably a few hundred database queries over the course of navigating the first few screens. So, you know, we're talking over the course of typical usage, I might make a few hundred to a few thousand database queries over like a, you know, a well-used session of the app. The background task API was designed back, you know, in the early days of iOS for you to take out like one background task assertion if you're like finishing uploading a file to a web service or doing like, you know, doing some kind of sync operation. Like, okay, take a background assertion, finish the sync operation, and then give it back. And so apparently this was designed for something more on the order of like hundreds of these to happen during a process, not thousands of these to happen the way I was doing it with every database query. And this was causing two problems. Number one, it would cause this watchdog that goes around to check to see if you've exceeded your limits. It would cause it to kill my app to say, hey, you've exceeded your limits. But apparently there was also a bug in that watchdog that in older versions of iOS before 11 that sometimes if you had such a ridiculous number of them as I did, that watchdog would crash. And because it's a part of the system, if that crashes, basically all of Springboard comes down and is brought back up. This has been fixed in iOS 11, but it was not fixed for at least the earlier parts of 10. I don't know if the very last version of 10 might have fixed it. I don't know, honestly. But so basically, Overcast was not only exposing its own limit crossing behavior. And by the way, I don't know what that limit is. Nobody will tell me what that limit is. It doesn't really matter for my purposes. All that matters is background tasks are something to be, you know, used not in the thousands. But basically, I was causing Springboard to crash. And I greatly, greatly appreciate both the user who sent me the video who showed that it would be terminated after a certain number of minutes because that allowed me to get the crash code that was reliably causing this problem. And I also greatly appreciate anybody inside Apple who helped me track this down. And I greatly don't appreciate the blog post I read back forever ago, and I'm glad I can't find it now. But so I'm telling you all now, any developers listening, don't use background task IDs for frequently occurring things like database queries. That is too granular. And the solution to the problem ended up being something totally different. We are sponsored this week by Betterment, investing made better. Go to betterment.com/ATP to learn more. Betterment is a smarter way to invest your money, providing investing advice through smart technology, automated investing, and human advisors. They have changed the industry by using the same strategies that financial advisors use with clients who have millions of dollars, but now making those available to everyone. This includes advanced strategies such as smart rebalancing, global diversification, tax harvesting, and so much more. Betterment's mission is to help you manage and grow your investments to build your financial future, and all with low fees so you lose less of your money along the way. Because if you do the math, typical investment fees and costs really add up over time, and Betterment's fees are a fraction of the cost of other financial services. And Betterment's so easy to use that they've won awards for their customer experience. You can log into a demo account right on their website if you're curious to see it. And ATP listeners can get up to 1 year managed for free. For more information, visit betterment.com/ATP. Terms and conditions apply, and investing involves risk. To learn more, visit betterment.com/ATP. That's betterment.com/ATP. Betterment, investing made better. So going back to the original problem, the problem was I was holding on to a shared file lock in the shared app container because the database file, so very quick overview. I apologize to non-programmers. This is probably very boring. I've been trying to not talk about this for weeks, and John's finally making me this week. But anyway, so...
And not just him.
Okay, you too. I'm not voted. So anyway, long explanation, slightly less long again. iOS apps are totally isolated from each other. They, you know, for security reasons, for control reasons, for user-friendliness, there's lots of good reasons. iOS apps... If your app wants to read or write a file for its own data purposes, it writes it in a special sandbox folder that it can't read or write anything outside of that, and no other apps can read its files. And this is extremely enforced such that even if you have multiple apps from the same developer, they are isolated from each other. Even if you have extensions of your app, because an extension is technically running as a separate process on the system, the extension can't read and write the same data as its parent app, even. Like, that's how walled off everything is in iOS for various, you know, good security reasons. Which, by the way, I love, and I kind of wish that the Mac had more of that. Anyway, Apple created a system called Shared App Group Containers to try to solve the problem of, first of all, you know, if you have multiple apps from the same developer, can they share any information? And then second of all, if you just have an app with an extension, how do you, it's pretty hard to make a useful extension that can't read or write any of its parent app's data. The shared app container is basically it's literally what it sounds like. It's a shared container that apps and extensions can all read and write from, you know, separately, you know, separately from their main data space, so they can share data. I had the bright idea back when watchOS first came out, and I had to make my watch extension, which was Overcast's first extension. What if I just move the database file into the shared app container, and then the extension can read and write the same database as the app, and I can copy the same model files over and have the extension have a lot of code sharing with the main app? The thing with iOS is that processes can be randomly suspended and terminated without their, you know, consent or whatever, as the system deems them no longer necessary if the user quits it, whatever else. And this is especially enforced on extensions. If you open up, say, a widget, like used to be called Today Widget now, and I think they're just called widgets now, right?
I don't even remember.
Whatever they're called in this iOS release. So widgets have very, very low limits because you might have a screen that has like five of them on it. Like if you open up your whatever notification center is called now, and you have the part of the notification center that used to be called Today screen, that who knows what that's called now. Anyway, so you have all these things that might be called widgets on that screen. and so each one of those is running a separate process. And so they have very, very aggressive limits on those. In the context of a widget, or actually any extension technically, there is no such thing as a background task assertion in the typical sense where you say, you know, begin background task and I'll tell you when I'm done. They have this other thing, this NS process info API, that is horrendous and really hard to use. But basically, they very aggressively terminate the processes of those extensions whenever you're done with them. So the problem is, if you have a shared app group container and you have the ability for one of these processes to take a lock on a file in that, you have a problem then. What do you do if, say, the widget has a lock on the database file, which is the single copy that's shared between the parent app and everything else? If the widget takes a lock on that file and then gets terminated before the lock is released, what should happen? Should the lock not be released? Then the app can't run because it's deadlocked. It's waiting for that lock to be released from the extension that's not running right now. Or should you just kind of force the lock to be released? Well, then you have the risk of data corruption, because then if the widget then relaunches, the widget thinks the file has been locked that whole time in the meantime, but it actually hasn't. So the lock is kind of meaningless, you either have lots of bugs or you have data corruption or whatever else. So Apple, realizing this would be a problem, built in this wonderful system the special springboard crasher, that you will get a log if your app is terminated while it's holding a lock in the shared container. You get these crazy crash logs that were the kind I was getting to begin with. This was the problem I was trying to solve at the beginning, and the reason I did this whole background task thing that was horrendous. Finally, the end of the story. I had that problem for that reason, and I tried to solve it with this background task on every database query thing, which was a terrible idea that caused this other springboard crash, this way, way, way worse crash. And so instead, I decided, you know what? I'm just not going to have the database in the share container anymore. I just moved it. I moved it back into the Ask Private Storage. And instead of the widget communicating with and the watch extension, instead of them communicating with the parent app by reading and writing the database directly, now they just have their own little mini APIs to the parent app where they're communicating via dictionaries that are just being written to little files in the share container that are not locked or anything like that. So I took this, you know, elegant but complex solution of having the database be shared and made a much, much, much simpler, lower tech solution of just passing around serialized dictionaries as unlocked files, basically. And now all these problems are gone. It is totally solved. My crash rate has dropped to, you know, barely anything, relatively speaking. And it is finally done. And my users were very patient during this time, and I greatly appreciate that, along with the guy who reported the initial bug and the Apple people who helped me find it. So that is the story. I think this was now, because this was before the WWDC barrier in the year of Apple scheduling, I have very little recollection of most of these details, so I apologize if I got anything wrong. I apologize for the long-winded nature of this, but Casey and John made me do it.
So I have a couple of questions about this.
Yeah.
How many database queries were you making?
I never really measured like what exactly the threshold of being a problem was, but I think it's in the order of, you know, it's in the magnitude of hundreds over a short time, and then maybe approaching thousands if you use the app for a while and it's doing a lot of, you know, because the app syncs back to the server, you know, every few minutes. As you're listening, every few seconds it's writing your progress back to the database. That way, in case it crashes or your phone crashes or whatever else, that you don't lose too much progress. So every few seconds I'm writing to the disk at least. And then when you're doing a sync, there's a lot more queries that go on there. And if you browse a list, it's loading all that data as you page through that list. You know, as you scroll, it's loading all those table cells for all the episodes, so it's loading all that stuff. So I do a good amount of queries.
That's my question. So like when you're scrolling through lists, it's like loading them on the fly at that point with like for the data source of whatever it's called, the data provider for the table view or whatever.
Yep.
And it's not like pulling the whole list and keeping it in memory and then just doling it out to the GUI data source provider thingy. Like you don't just do one big giant query up front to get the whole playlist and then just keep it in memory and chuck it out as the table cells ask for it.
Well, I do. And I have some caching built into the database layer as well. So for instance, like, you know, I do load the whole list of episodes for a playlist view. But then as you scroll, I need to know like the artwork, you know, and that comes from the podcast record, not the episode record. Like that's like one level up. And so I have podcasts cached, like I have that, you know, in a nice, you know, instance cache and everything. But keep in mind, a lot of this stuff falls over if people have a lot of podcasts. You know, like if it exceeds what my app reasonably expects to cache or what will reasonably fit in memory to cache, there's a lot more queries happening as this stuff is paged in. Also, if things change, for instance, if I get a changed value from the server, it invalidates a lot of these values that are cached, so I have to then reload those on their next request. If the list of playable content changes, which basically is like if a new episode comes in, or if an episode gets deleted, or if some criteria of an episode changes whether it is a member of a playlist or not, then that is called, you know, in my app I call that the playable content change, which is basically like the some part of what belongs in the list of episodes somewhere is no longer valid, and when that happens, lots of things get invalidated. And so there's a lot going on. I mean, a podcast app is a lot more complex than most people would assume. It's certainly more complex than I assumed when I started writing one, as I've found out. And they're only getting more complex over time as the market matures and as the scope of these things, the scope of what people expect, expands.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, you know, like a, I guess you probably get it in just looking at the console log or using instruments or something, like the flow of database queries. Because I, you know, using Overcast, everything, well, you know, this does some database queries, but surely I would never guess the size of the number of database queries, like over the course of a 10-minute period, that it would literally do thousands, like especially just during normal use, even accounting for the, hey, I'm syncing your play position every few seconds. So I found that pretty surprising in this whole thing. And also I would say that whatever that blog post was that you found that was like just do everything as a background task. Can't really blame the blog post, because any solution like that is like the underlying assumption is you're not doing hundreds or thousands of database queries. Like, you've got a couple database queries and you do them and just put them in the background, you'll be fine. And you would have been fine if the number was like 20, you know, like a couple a minute, like five database queries every minute. But if it's hundreds or thousands, then obviously that solution's not going to work. Another question about your not having the database in the shared container and just having the thing write pls to the shared container, does that mean that the main Overcast app has to like be running to notice those things appearing in the shared container and take action on them because it owns the database now? Like, how does that work?
It would mean that, but for a variety of reasons, it either always is running or becomes running. So let me go through. Basically, there's only two extensions that matter for this purpose. One of them is the widget. The other one is the Watch app. When watchOS, WatchKit 1, back with for watchOS 1, the extension for the watch was actually a process running on the phone. And so it had access to the shared data container on the phone. So it was actually surprisingly easy to make WatchKit 1 apps, because you could just share the database, share all the model files and everything, and then just have the WatchKit read and write the database directly. And it kind of took care of that for you. WatchKit 2 and forward, so watchOS 2 and 3 and also now 4, moved the extension to run on the watch itself instead of on the phone, because running it on the phone made the apps really slow, basically, because it had to send all the interface stuff over Bluetooth and it sucked. That's one of the reasons why watchOS 1 was so bad for apps, and why the newer watchOS since then have been so much better. Anyway, so when the extension execution moved to the watch, that meant it could no longer read and write the container anymore, because the container's on the phone. So that, you know, so it had its own container on the watch now. But anyway, it couldn't read and write the database. So that eliminated the whole reason I had it there in the first place. The only reason this came up is that when I made Overcast 3.0, I made a widget. And the widget was like the first time I was really using or really taking advantage of the fact that the database was somewhere shared to begin with. The watch extension already needed to have ways to communicate with the app, to wake it up if need be, and everything. And the watch connectivity framework allows for all that. Like, there's different commands and stuff that, you know, there are ways for the, like, it basically is already communicating the way that I said I moved everything to. It was really only the widget that was causing the problems, and you know, because I'd already made this move with the watch app anyway. So the widget, either the phone app is already running, in which case it notices anyway, or basically I have a mechanism in the widget, because the widget has a play button. And if you tap into the artwork in it, it'll play that one also. So the widget needs to have some way to wake up the app. If it was just one-way data transfer, if the widget was just like showing status from the app, like you might have if you made like a weather app, for instance, like there'd be no reason for the widget to communicate back to the parent app and something like that. You know, you might just have the widget launch the app, but that's, you know, you can do that already. In my app, I had to have some way for the widget to communicate back to the app. And the app might not be running. So what I did for that was the widget basically sends a command through one of these serialized playlists. It puts a file in the shared app container that says, hey, do this command. And if it doesn't get a response within some very short time, I think it's like a half a second or something, then I launch a URL scheme that launches the app in the foreground. And you'll notice that if you use it. If basically the app was already running, if you hit that play button in the widget, it'll start again in the background because the app was still running. So basically, this is all a giant pile of hacks. But the short version is the widget tries to send the app a command, and if it doesn't get a response, it knows it isn't running, so it launches it in the foreground.
So my final question, because every Overcast segment would not be completed without some kind of bug report / feature request, is...
Oh, my word.
I'm still...
This better not be about offline watch playback. I swear I'm going to set that feature on fire.
No, it is not. I know about your woes with that, and I did try it myself, and I had my own woes because the volume was too low and I couldn't hear anything, but you know about that already.
It's getting worse. It's getting so much worse.
But my question is about the mysterious world of the internal state of something on my phone that decides what it is that will start playing when my phone connects to Bluetooth on my car. So often I will enter my car... And I just did it today, actually. Before I entered the car, I unlocked my phone and looked, and either I used the multitasking switcher to go to it, or I tapped the Overcast icon, or it was already in it. But the point is, Overcast was the frontmost application, right? I had previously been listening to a podcast. I was not listening now. I think I double-tapped my AirPods and, like, put them away or whatever. But Overcast is the frontmost app. So I hit the sleep button, I go into my car, connects to Bluetooth, and instead of Overcast continuing to play the thing I was just listening to, music starts to play. And I have no idea how iOS determines what it should start playing when I get into my car and it connects to Bluetooth. But maybe 15% of the time, it starts playing music instead of playing... sometimes, like, Overcast is long gone. Like, it kind of makes sense. Like, last time I listened to Overcast was last night, and I've since used Twitter and browsed the web and done all sorts of stuff. Surely Overcast is not running anymore because I've just thrashed through the memory. And so when I get into my car, maybe it's going to be like, oh, I should start playing a random playlist, right? But when Overcast is the frontmost app and I was just listening to it and it starts playing music, it makes me realize I have no idea what the hell's going on inside there. I'm assuming you have very little control over this, as with so many things that seem like OS level things, but can you shed some light on what the hell is going on there?
Sure. I mean, I can tell you right now I have zero control over it, but I will tell you roughly what I know is happening. And a lot of this is conjecture. A lot of this is just figuring it out over time with experience. And some of this, very little of this has been documented before, but not most of it. So the short version is it tries to do whatever you did last, but there are some exceptions to when this will happen. So first of all, a lot of times, especially recently with the rise of video clips on Twitter and Facebook, what you did last might not be what you think you did last, or you might have forgotten, or it might have been something. So for example, if you are, you know, if Overcast is paused and you're looking at Twitter and you view some kind of embedded video clip, Twitter has just become the most recently audio playing app. And iOS keeps track of whatever the most recently audio-playing app was for this purpose. But lots of things can take it. So anything that plays video, anything that plays audio, if you view a video in Safari, for instance, that becomes then the latest, you know, the last app that played audio. So it could be lots of different things that you don't even realize are taking it over. But if you, like, you know, play that quick video and then it stops, it doesn't give the, like, last audio app status back to what it had before. It just stays on whatever that was. So much of the time in practice, that's the problem, is you actually did play audio through something else and either subconsciously assumed that it would go back to Overcast after that, or that it just that you just forgot or didn't realize that, that's happening.
That makes sense, but that's never the case with me because I've never heard it do a tweet. And I think I've done what you've described, like played a video on Twitter, played a video on YouTube, but I've never heard it resume a YouTube video, resume a tweet video, resume anything. It always starts playing seemingly random playlists in my music collection. And I can tell you, I'm not listening to music on my iPhone, like, ever. Like, because I have a dedicated iPod connected with a USB cable in my car. Like, I don't even listen to my phone music on my phone in my car. I have a separate iPod for that, right? And it's amazing to me, and I know it's doing it because it's taking a really long time. It's amazing to me. I don't know how it picks the playlist, because it's not even like the playlist that I was last, like, if I go into a music app intentionally and play a song and then forget about it, and then, like, it just, I don't know what it's doing. Is it honoring my shuffle? But anyway, it always plays music, and it takes forever for it to start playing music because I have never even launched the music app. So
right. So yeah. There's other things at play here. So first of all, even if it remembers properly that the last app you used was Overcast, if Overcast has crashed in the background, it won't resume. But, you know, again, I try to minimize background crashes. There are occasional ones that still happen that I'm still trying to track down, but they're they're relatively rare compared to other things. So that probably is not doing what you're doing now, but I can't tell you for sure it isn't. Other things that are at play here. If it tries to resume something like in a car setting like that, and the last used audio app does not respond in a certain amount of time, I think iOS defaults to music. There's also this has been a problem for cars for a while that had iPod support. There are these iPod control protocols that work over both USB and Bluetooth, I think, and if a car has iPod support, what will sometimes happen is the car will basically invoke that instead of, like, the generic Bluetooth play thing. And iOS devices, when prompted for music support, try to do the right thing. They try to show their music library to the car. And you said that the music is kind of random. So it used to be, whenever it would ask for the iPod library music stuff, it used to be that most of them would default to playing the first alphabetical song title.
Yeah.
So like whatever song you had that began with A in your mm-hmm. in your library, it would just play that every time.
Yeah, my car does that with the USB connected iPod Touch. It always goes with the A yeah. songs. And here's the thing. It still takes me like two songs to figure out what it's doing. I don't know why I haven't identified the first song. The second song, sometimes I'm up to the third song because I kind of like the first two songs. It's like, oh, this is good. Oh, and I do use random play. It's like, oh, conceivably, could have picked the song random. But by the third song, I'm like, wait a second. These all begin with A. And like, how many years am I going to do that? I'm dumb.
And just as a note, okay, as this episode has been somewhat about, I'm not perfect. I make a lot of mistakes. But as a note to people who implement these kind of audio systems, nobody ever wants to play songs alphabetically by their titles. That is never a thing anybody ever wants. It is never the right idea. That just never, ever, ever do that. And there are so many like cars and things that do that. Sometimes it's the only option for in certain like views or certain parts of the UI. Nobody wants alphabetical song playback. Ever. Just don't do that. Anyway, it seems like in recent times, Apple has figured out, okay, nobody wants to hear All In by Stroke 9 every single morning when they get in their car. Let's instead play something from Apple Music that they might like. So if you subscribe to Apple Music, you often get that, where like your car will suddenly start playing just some radio station or some playlist off of your phone if it can't figure out what else to do and the car is requesting music. So that's a thing, too. And that's been, I think, in the last two iOS versions, I think since iOS 10 at least. You know, there's lots of things that your car and your phone can negotiate and do. What you quickly realize as you dive into this stuff is that this is just an incredibly complex system, and most of it's complex for a reason. Like, you know, iOS's whole concept of the last used, you know, music playing or audio playing app, that is complex in itself because of all the things I mentioned, like videos and Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. You know, embedded stuff in Safari, you know, YouTube videos. Like, it's so complex to even just try to keep track in a reasonable way of like, what was the last app that played media? And so if the user says play, what should I play? So I don't have a good answer for you, except it might be one of those things, or it might be something else.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, like I said, most of the time it works. 85% of the time, 90% of the time, it does what I expect it to do. But it's the times that it doesn't. I'm like, well, what was your problem this time? What you said about it trying to get it to play, but like it giving up after a short period of time and then going to music rings true for me because it always seems to take longer. I can always tell when, I'm not going to hear my podcast, I'm going to hear music, because everything on my car takes a long time in terms of Bluetooth and booting up and everything, you know. And so these are counted in seconds. I can say, oh, I know what's gonna happen next. It's gonna play music, and it does. But almost all the time it works. So anyway, another thing. I mean, I guess that can be solved by Honda updating their in-car infotainment system. Which, by the way, they did. The new Accords have an all-new Android-based, presumably non-disgusting. You know, like what I have now is like pre-Android iOS, like the old world of car infotainment systems, the bad old world, and the new one is just, you know, the modern era. So I'm hoping it's better, and I'm hoping they put faster CPUs in, and I'm hoping it will take less time to connect to Bluetooth. So at the very least, I can get the wrong thing playing faster. But in the meantime, wow. I will just, you know, I mean, it's pretty high success rate, all things considered, but yeah, it does sound complicated. It almost makes me wish that there was a way that I could say, look, all I ever want to happen ever, ever, ever when I enter the car is for you to start playing Overcast. And that's it. But that doesn't seem like it's in the cards.
So before you get a ton of email, hopefully, you were able to back channel kind of directly to Apple and say, hey, what's going on here? What do you think would have been your course of action if that wasn't available to you? Like, aren't there
DTS ticket would be the next thing.
Exactly what I thought. So if you're not Marco Arment and you know, yeah, that's fine for Marco, but you would have opened a DTS ticket and hypothetically that would have been escalated to an engineer who could have helped you, hopefully, maybe.
Yeah. And the way these works, and forgive me for not having the details right, because I've actually never filed one, but basically every paid Apple developer membership includes, I believe, two developer technical support, that's DTS, incidents per year. And you basically, like, you know, you say you want to use one, and you can actually get like code level support. You can actually say, like, you know, okay, look, here's this code. It is not working here. I can't figure this out. Can you help? And Apple engineers will actually help you with that problem. And so it's a pretty involved process. That's why they're limited. So it's two per year, and I think there's some provision where, like, if what you found is actually an Apple bug, then I think they don't like charge you your ticket for that year. They don't accumulate, so, you know, I would have a lot if they did, but they don't. But yeah, so there actually is this, you know, there is a way to do this. And while I have no experience with it myself, I've heard from people who have used them that they're incredibly helpful. And so this is something that all developers have access to. So that's pretty cool.
That's awesome. All right, we good?
I mean, I could tell some more long, boring stories if you want.
Well, we got to figure out an after show, because I have something brief, but I don't know if it's going to be worth it.
So. Oh, I know what we should do. All right, thanks to our three sponsors this week, Betterment, Eero, and Fracture. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
So, John, tell us about your mongoose Californian.
you're trying to really clear out the things in there.
Wait, we have to set the stage. So, forever and a day ago, the very top of our show notes has some sections, and then including follow-up, and then the topics, right? So, the very, very, very top, like the fifth line down, in sitting in this document for maybe a year now, is my mongoose Californian, parenthesis, 1984, parenthesis, and two links. And this has been sitting there staring us at the face, at the top of this document for probably a year, maybe two. It's been 3 years. Yep. Now is the time that we are going to finally clear this out. Good call, Marco.
The thing that we really should be clearing out is, like, early on, someone, probably Casey, was trying to put sections in the notes. We didn't have names for things. It's, you know, the naming problem with programming again. Like, it hadn't actually come up with you know, precise names for things. So there's all sorts of, like, pre-post-show, public post-show, after-show, pre-show. Like, we didn't have the names for all the different times that we can talk to each other. The times when we're live, when we're not live, blah, blah, blah. So this section got anchored up here with public post show, which now we call the after show and is lower in the document. And so that's how old this was. So I will be able to delete this entire section when we do this. The problem with this topic is it was a thing I was angry about. I was angry about it in 2014, unfortunately. It's hard for me to muster that anger again.
Oh, really? Is that so, John? Well, I demand that you do it, because you made me dig up my crash story.
You weren't angry about it.
I was angry.
It's like a detective story. The anger should have subsided. Now you've defeated the beast. Now you can look back on it, and it's more like a detective story. If, like, there was this mystery, and I solved it, and it was weird, and it's like a programming problem. So if I had you do it in the middle of it, like your app is currently out there and crashing, and you still can't figure out what it is, and then you talked about it, that would be a different story. But anyway, I'll see what I can do to bring myself back to 2014. This is precipitated by me being on a podcast that we'll link in the show notes, Storming Mortal, where I talked about a whole bunch of things, including, in the words of a show that, God help me, Casey must have seen, and please, Marco, know that at least exists, the best Christmas present I ever received and ever would receive, my 1984 Mongoose Californian BMX bike. Casey, do you know what I was referencing?
Nope.
Please?
No, not a bit. God.
Come on, guys. Come on.
What was it? Maybe if you tell me.
Did I get it wrong? The best Christmas present I ever received and ever would receive. I'm close. I'm really close on that.
You're not close enough for us.
A Christmas Story. They only play it 24 hours a day.
Oh, I've only seen it like once or twice.
Oh, what do you mean you've only seen it once or twice?
I think I've seen it all the way through.
They play it literally 24 hours.
I know. I never pay attention.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things that's it's always on, and so you never pay attention.
If you had said you'll shoot your eye out with that thing, I would have known immediately.
Well, but at least there's that. Anyway, that movie, by the way, is a really, really, really good movie. Ignore the fact that it's played 24 hours. They used to not play it 24 hours. It is a really good movie. The kid in the movie gets a BB gun for Christmas, and he says, the narrator, the older version of it, says the best Christmas present he ever received and ever would receive. So that's my bike for a variety of reasons. And the reason...
Wait, the reference we were supposed to recognize there was not the bike itself, just the best present that, you know...
It's a line...
Just that
it's
part?
Like very, very near the end of the movie. It's like the second or third to last line in the movie.
Oh, jeez. We didn't stand a chance.
Nope.
It's a pretty significant line. It's a pretty significant sentiment. Anyway, I should get that quote exactly right so I can repeat it with more confidence in the future. Anyway, on this podcast, we talked about a whole bunch of things. I also talked about BMX. And around this time, I was buying bicycles for my kids of various sizes, like non-training wheel bikes, like their first like real bikes. And I found that experience incredibly frustrating. So I grew up in a bike culture, which is like 70s, 80s, suburban New York metro area. It was a bike culture. Kids were on bicycles.
Can I tell people that you're a biker?
Different thing, different context. Although we did put playing cards in our spokes with a clothespin, so your bikes sound like motorcycles.
Oh, yeah. That really confused anybody ever.
That's right. It was awesome. So kids were on bikes all the time. Like, if you watch a Steven Spielberg movie showing kids in the 70s race and they're riding around on bicycles, if you watch Stranger Things and kids are riding around on bicycles, that was a real thing. That's all we did. We'd come home from school, we'd get on our bikes, we'd go all over the place. Nobody had helmets. We would fashion jumps out of garbage we found in other people's trash on trash day in the middle of the street. It's all very dangerous and scary, and we would never let our kids do it today, but that's what we did. And because we were in a bike culture and bikes were so important, there's a hierarchy of what kind of bike you had, and all the fancy rich kids had Mongoose or Redline, which were expensive bikes, and I wanted a Mongoose. I think I thought Redlines were more expensive. I don't even think they were, but that's what I thought. And I wanted one for Christmas, and I thought there's no way I'm going to get one because they're really expensive, and they were. And my parents totally surprised me with it, like the present. Aww. That you don't think you're ever going to get. It's not even I was like hopeful for it, looking for it. It didn't even enter my mind. It's like being a kid and saying I want a Lamborghini Countach, and you're like, yeah, but like whatever, I'm not going to get one. And then you wake up on Christmas morning, it's in your garage and it's yours, right? It was like that basically. And I rode the hell out of that bicycle. I rode it everywhere, jumped it off jumps and dirt bikes and trails, rode up and down highways on it. This bike has no gears, by the way. It's a BMX bike. Like, it's just straight up. You know, took really good care of it, you know, cleaned it and oiled it all the time. Like, all the things you can imagine me doing this bike is like my prized possession. I still have this bicycle. It's still in my house.
Oh, my word.
Wow.
In the attic?
In the basement. I tried to get my kids to ride the bike, right? It's like the reason I saved it for my kids.
Yeah, but they couldn't care less.
A, they didn't care, and B, they didn't like it, right? But, I rode the bike. Here I am, 30-something years old, on my BMX bike. You know what? It's still a really good bike. You get on it and you can tell this is, you know, it's not a complicated thing. It's got pedals and a gear, then a chain that connects to another gear and some handbrakes and tires. And of course, the tires have been replaced over the years because, you know, I went through many tires and many inner tubes over the time of owning this. But pretty much everything else on it is original. And to this day, like, how old is this bike? It's a 1984 bike. It rides great. You pedal and it feels like, I don't know, like I'm going to, for Casey, like a BMW manual transmission, or like a Swiss watch. Mm-hmm. for Marco. Swiss watches are still hard, like precision piece of machinery. There is no slippage. There is no slop. All the bearings in it are smooth. There is very, very little friction. The brakes are a little crappy because, you know, the pads and the brakes have been replaced many times and they're kind of, you know, hard and crusty from being in the basement. But the pedaling experience on this bike, there are no squeaks and rattles, 100% solid. So when I'm looking for bikes for my kids, I'm like, well, you know, they don't, whatever. I just need any old bike, right? But, you know, me being the obnoxious suburban rich dad trying to buy things that are too expensive for his kids, I was like, well, let me try to get, you know, I know it's just a kid's bike, but let me get a good quality one because I want my kids to have a good quality, but not just some cruddy like Toys R Us made of like some weird, terrible, cheap aluminum alloy that you can bend with your fingers that's just going to fall apart or rust or just, you know, bend if it goes off a little bump in the road. I want to get a good bike, right? And maybe it'll have good resale value or whatever. And I'm looking to try to find one, a kid size, you know, not an adult bike, but a kid size bike. I'm not going to spend thousands of dollars, but I would spend, you know, a couple hundred bucks on it or whatever. That maybe it's not going to be as good as my Mongoose, but just is competent. That, you know, you pedal and it feels like you are pushing yourself forward. You don't feel the gears in the chain or any other stuff like that. And we went through a couple of bikes and a couple of different ways to get them and a couple of different stores. And I felt like Marco, buying something and then returning it and buying something and then returning it, because they were all just terrible.
I hardly sometimes, ever did
that. Sometimes they the problem was like the shipment. Like the shipment would come and the box would be damaged. You could see that it was like crushed and like the gears would have been like jammed against concrete or something because the little teeth on the gears were bent because you could tell that the paint was shaved off. Sometimes you'd get it and, you know, no matter how much you tried to lubricate things in it and get it up and running, it always just, you know, the bike chain would bend and get a kink in it and never straighten out, or the chain would jump off. And, you know, I know how to, I have a lot of experience fixing and maintaining bikes over my life, all the way up to 10 speeds and everything when I was older. Like, I know what I'm doing. And these bikes were just crap. Every part of them was crap. Their bearings, if they had them at all, were crap. The parts were not precisely manufactured. They were made of crappy metal that I could bend with my fingernails. The paint jobs were terrible. They were heavy. They were ugly. They were slow. They felt terrible. Every one of them was like, I wouldn't have traded 1,000 of them for my Mongoose, right? And I didn't understand why, you know, what the deal is with bikes. Like, is it only like super adult, multi-$1,000, even more obnoxious rich dude bikes that you have to get? Like, is that the only place good quality components are? Even Mongoose, which is a brand that still exists. And I think Redline still exists too. Their bikes are these weird monstrosities that just don't seem to be the quality they used to. And it got me into the super duper old man, you know, second only to my literal telling children to get off my lawn, of like, they don't make things like they used to.
Wait, do you do that?
That was one of my, that's my favorite tweet I have ever made. I gotta look it up for the show notes. So this is the tweet. I'm going to try to recite it from memory. The school bus stops in front of my house. This morning, I found myself literally telling children to get off my lawn. This is a real thing that happened because the school bus stop is in front of my house. And when the school bus stop, the kids are like, oh, let's just go on this lawn here and like play ball and like run around and, you know, stomp through the planting beds and throw balls so they end up hitting our house. And out there, I told the kids to get off my lawn. Because, like, seriously, you think you wouldn't do this. But just think about it. If you had a bus stop in front of your house and every single morning a fleet of children are there just running around and stomping on your downspouts and bending them and crushing your bushes and throwing balls and bouncing off their house and the balls hitting your car and your driveway, Casey, you would go out there and you would tell the kids to get off your lawn. So I literally went out and told the kids to get off my lawn.
The school bus stop is in front of my house, period. I am now literally telling children to get off my lawn, period. Yeah. 8th of January, too. 2009.
And you would too. You know, that's the oldest. But the second oldest I ever felt is, and I heard my grandfather say this all the time, and I mostly just ignored him and rolled his eyes, but he would show me how they don't make them like they used to. Like, they don't make him, with him, it was cars, right? And I contend they do not make bikes for kids like they used to. That there is no bike at any price anywhere in the world that is of equal quality to my 1984 Mongoose Californian. In terms of the simple machine with bearings and pedals and wheels and chains that takes your leg energy and turns it into forward momentum. That stupid thing in my basement right now, hanging from the ceiling, is better than anything you can get at any price. And I find that depressing. And I'm assuming it's just because I don't know the secret place and the secret brands for today's good bikes, or maybe kids don't like bikes at all until they're adults and, you know, ride grown-up bikes. But anyway, that was depressing, and I ended up getting my kids a series of terrible bikes from, like, I think they had a couple from bike stores and a couple from Target, and it's like, it doesn't matter how much you spend or where you get them. I just resigned to the fact that they're all crap. So just, you know, after, in the end times, instead of pushing a shopping cart through the ruins of civilization, I will be the 50-year-old man riding a way too small for him BMX bike that is awesome.
John, I have good news, my friend. You have successfully mustered up the appropriate amount of anger.
I was so much angrier then. Because, like, you know, it's the Marco style anger. Like, something that money can't fix? What is wrong with the world? I'm willing to spoil my children and buy them things that they shouldn't own, that they're not going to appreciate, and yet I can't? I'm not allowed to spoil my children?
The thing I want is not available on Amazon?
No, I was going to bike stores. I went to actual bike stores. We did actually buy a couple of bikes at bike stores. At least we got some that were sturdy from bike stores at tremendous expense, mind you. But I'm totally willing to support a bike store if it's going to keep a bike store in business. Because if you don't go to a bike store, it's Walmart, Target, Toys R Us, and like sporting goods stores, none of which know anything about bicycles. So if you have a local bike store, go there and give them whatever they want, because it is better than shopping elsewhere. I think you guys have, does Adam have a scoot bike?
He has a balance bike. I don't know if that's the same thing. It's basically a bike with no pedals.
Yeah, those are awesome.
Yeah, he has taken, like, he's had it now for over a year, I think, maybe even 2 years, and he took to it immediately and is really into it. It's almost to the point now where I was thinking about in a few weeks, I was thinking about like trying him on a real bike to see if he can do it yet, because I think he might be able to.
He's 100% ready. I've seen video of him doing it. He is ready for a bike. He is, you know, that scoot bike, he's totally mastered it. He's, yeah. And my kids never wanted to use a scoot bike. Of course we bought the scoot bikes. Oh, I understand the theory behind a scoot bike. It'll be awesome. My kids were like, nope, no way in hell I'm getting on that. So they took a long time to learn how to ride bikes. But Adam's going to be riding a bike tomorrow if you give him a bike with pedals. Don't even bother with the training wheels. He's ready.
Yeah. I didn't ride a bike until like middle school. It took me a long time. Same, because I was like,
this doesn't surprise.
Yeah, like I was really into scooters and just didn't really. I thought I didn't need the bike.
You didn't understand mechanical advantage.
Not at all. No. Yeah. So it took me.
Then you
entered
middle school and you learned about levers and other simple machines.
Well, and actually, I at the beach, it's like a no cars community. Like there's no cars anywhere. So
only wagons.
Yeah. Everyone bikes everywhere. And there were some bikes in the basement of this place. And so, I took one out in the last couple times we've been there and started riding it around. And I haven't ridden a bike since my high school bike, which was never quite adult size. It was like a couple inches smaller than like a regular. It was like,
to be fair.
Yeah,
are you really adult size?
I didn't even see where that was going.
Yeah,
I was just gonna say, to be fair, and hoping you would auto complete the joke, but I had to go a little farther.
So I started riding it, and first of all, riding a bike when you haven't ridden one in, you know, probably 20 years.
It's just like riding a bike.
Yeah, the old saying, "Oh, it comes right back to you." I mean, yes, but not well, and it's terrifying. And also, like, the bike...
Well, wait a second. I took a long break riding bikes, too, like most people. Like, you ride a bike when you're a kid, and then you become an adult, and you get a license, you get a car. So I think there was a pretty big gap between riding my bikes. In my experience, it was like riding a bike. I had no problem. I'm like, of course I know how to do this. Maybe your gap was longer than mine, or maybe you didn't have the hours, the flight hours, in the seat of a bike, but... I just rode my bike. I rode my bike to pick up my car from the body shop where I got the scratches fixed in my paint, and I had to go pick up the car. But of course, you can't drive a car to pick up the car, so I had to ride my bike to pick up the car. That's not the first time I've ridden a bike in a long time. But anyway, in my experience, it was just like riding a bike and wasn't terrifying. But maybe your gap was longer.
Well, it kind of an exacerbating factor is that the bike that was in the basement of this house is. Not only very, very old and has a lot of rust and failing parts, like it is an 18-speed mountain bike. I don't know what brand. I don't think it would be a brand anybody would recognize it. Like it isn't. It's a cheap bike, but it's also a cheap old bike that has been around sea air for a long time. So there's lots of rust, and it's to the point where like the gears, like if you shift the big gear like by the pedals, if you shift that, the thing falls off. Like the thing that moves the gears back and forth, like it just falls off, and you have to like it jams up in weird ways, and you have to like unjam it in weird ways.
You get kinks in your chain too,
something like that. Yeah, but only if you shift the middle gear, and then the back gears, like the smaller ones that are supposed to be like more fine grained, the gear shifting thing seems to just like skip every two or three at a time. So it is technically an 18 speed, but I can only actually get it to engage maybe three distinct speeds. And they're very far apart from each other. So I basically keep it in one gear.
When I rode to get my car, I was using, you know, some ancient, like, it was like a given to us by a friend who was going to throw it in the garbage. And the same problem. It's like a mountain bike with a whole bunch of gears. And in theory, you have a whole bunch of them. But in practice, it jumps over all the gears. And the worst part for me is because I have kinks in the chain, if you try to pedal hard, the chain pops off the teeth.
Oh, jeez.
And then catches again, like, seven notches later. And that is the worst thing when you're trying to pedal. It's like, I don't blame that bike. I know there are available good mountain bikes if I was willing to buy them. I'm just using a hand-me-down bike. But, yeah, riding a bad bike feels gross.
The other problem is this bike is way too tall for me. Like, it's, first of all, not comfortable.
You have your tippy toes to reach the pedal.
I have to almost jump onto it. Like, that's how tall. Like, it's way too tall.
We need some video of this. What is Tiff periscoping, if not this?
Right! You took the words right out of my mouth. Like, of all the stuff that you've periscoped.
And the seat is at the bottom. Like, it can't be adjusted any further down than where it is now. And it's just too big for me.
We can get you to do a running start and get that on periscope. You got to do the running start and jump on.
Yeah, it's quite terrifying. Like, if I have to slow down, like, to go around some people on the sidewalk, I just have to just stop and just put my feet down. I'll just wait for them to pass.
Well, at least, like, you can put your feet down. When the seats are really high, like when I first got a couple of my 10 speeds, or when I'd ride my dad's 10 speeds, my feet couldn't reach the ground. I would have to jump off of the seat. And even when it was on the bar, it'd be like resting on my balls, tilted over so 1 foot could be on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I'm only putting 1 foot down. I don't quite have your bar issue, but it's not that far off. Like, it's really... So, yeah, actually, this was interesting. This is the second time I'm looking at bikes online today. Earlier today, I thought, you know, I would like to get, you know, obviously a bike that fits me for this place, because I'm about to go be there for a long time for my big summer vacation. So I would like to maybe get my own bike that actually fits me, that would be less terrifying to ride, and maybe has gears that work. So I thought maybe I should look at bikes. And then I thought, you know, if there's one bike that I would really want to have. Okay, John, you know the decade that we grew up in. Can you guess what bike I want?
I do know the decade you grew up in, but I didn't grow up in that decade. I know what the answer would be if you were my age, but I'm assuming because you're 90s children that you want some kind of gross mountain bikey thing with suspension.
Casey, can you guess the one bike I might want from our childhood?
Oh, the Pee Wee Herman bike?
Yep, there you go.
That's closer to my generation.
Oh, my word, I should have known.
Well, that's better than a gross mountain bike thing.
I want the bike from Pee Wee's Big Adventure, right? And it turns out that there is a community of people who make replicas of these bikes.
Oh, yeah.
But they only make them, like, for themselves as projects. Like, they basically never go for sale anywhere.
There's no gears on the Pee Wee bike. You don't want that.
Well, but actually, for the place that I'm staying at, like, there's no hills, and you can't go that fast because you're on sidewalks with people on them.
But it could be too high. It could be too tall geared, and then it's, like, hard to go slow.
I guess that's true. I imagine there would be some way to maybe swap out one, like the front gear or something, to fix that in some way, right?
I don't know. You can, but I would think you could get me a Pee Wee Herman replica bike because I'm Marco, but also give it to me with like five speeds or something.
It's a whole custom build anyway, so like I'm sure I can get them to make one that's actually my size and maybe give me three speeds. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe like I don't need a lot of speed.
It would not have occurred to me. Like I'm thinking like, well, he's going to get one of those expensive like, you know, carbon fiber racing bike. That's what, you know, that type of thing. And like those are going to cost a lot of money. It's like, no, Marco wants someone to build him a bike, some ridiculous bike from a movie.
Yeah, like one of them that was actually in the movie, like one of the actual prop bikes, sold on eBay in 2014 for $36,000.
Yeah, don't get that one, please.
So, yeah, well, I'm not going to get that. Also, I wouldn't want to ride that.
That one's not going to ride. It's not going to ride good.
Yeah. But and apparently, like, in order to build this bike, you have to get like a frame from, I think it's a Schwinn. It's some kind of like good bike frame from the 40s. Like the 1940s. Like that's you have to like find one of these frames and then get all this custom stuff to go around it. Like it's totally crazy. So
I'm all for these bikes as long as if I get on them and I pedal the pedals, I feel an efficient transfer of my leg force to forward momentum. I don't want to feel the gears or the chains or friction of the parts moving. I want to feel like my legs are magically attached to like forward momentum. And I swear to you, like no children's bike that I've sat on is like 1/8 as efficient as the Mongo. So if you're gonna spend all this money in the fancy bike, looks like the Pee Wee Herman bike, also make sure that when you pedal it, it feels like 100 times better than those crap bicycles you're trying to ride now. You're like, wow, suddenly biking is easier because all the friction has been taken out of this mechanical system.
And the other thing is, like, if I actually want to bike a lot in this beach place, there are parts of it, like, I can only go so far unless I'm willing to go on sand for some portion.
Then you end up in the ocean of the day. I know.
No. I mean, it's a long space island, but mm-hmm. there's at some point, like, there are certain parts where, like, there's just private property for the whole width of the island. So, like, you actually can't progress.
Or then the ticks get you. You can't go any farther. Oh, the ticks.
Well, you can if you're willing to drive in the sand for a little bit. So they have, like, there are people around there who have those, like, giant sand cruiser tire bikes, like the ones that have, like, the 5-inch tires. Mm-hmm. Like, so I actually, and there's a rental place there. So I think about renting one while I'm there just for a day and just try it and see if I imagine I'm going to hate trying to bike on sand. It's probably ridiculously hard.
Those tires don't make it that much easier.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's still biking on sand.
The other so basically I'm considering two options. The other option is an e-bike. Which is the very, you know, this is like,
oh,
this would be the high end option.
Oh, God.
So if you're willing to spend like $2,000 at least on a bike, you can get one that has an electric motor assist.
Why do you even say if?
And so, well, but listen, I'll address that in a second. So you can get one that has an electric motor assist and a small lithium battery in it. And those would be nice when going on the sand to just assist you through the sand, and you can get back on the pavement and turn the assist off. So that's one thing. However, one thing I really hate about the practicality of using a bike in a place like this is that you have to lock it. Locking a bike sucks, and bikes, you always have to worry so much about theft because they're stolen so often. And even if you get the most ridiculous locks, then they'll just, like, steal all the parts or whatever. Like,
are they going to be stolen where you are? Because there is a physical reason why bike thieves would have more difficulty, like, unless it's going to be stolen by your neighbor,
right? Yeah, it's like where are you going to take the bike? You're going to
go
on the ferry, like, yeah,
exactly.
But
you have time to catch them. There's a bottleneck. You just show up at the ferry with some goons and be like, "Where are you going to go? You drive it off into the ocean?" No, I know where you're going.
But I feel like there are two approaches here that would make sense. Number one, get a nice bike, you know, get like a PB Herman bike or something is of that style that I can really be proud of. Get like a nice, like a Schwinn, like a nice brand, and give it some gears, make it a really nice bike. And that's probably going to be about $1,000. Or you go the crazy e-bike route, but I don't think that's really necessary or practical or worth the cost necessarily.
It's, none of those things have ever bothered you before, ever.
True. Or just get the cheapest bike you can possibly find and just don't lock it. Like, who cares? Like, if you
they'll still steal it.
They will still steal, but if it's like a $60 Walmart bike, then it's like, it's a lot less of a loss, you know?
You don't want to ride that. You're going to be spending all your muscle strength will be going to friction. Those things is just not an enjoyable experience. It's terrible. Don't do it. I mean, you don't have to spend, there's something in between $2,000 and $60. You can buy a $200 bike, don't lock it, resign yourself that it's going to get stolen every 1.5 years and just go.
Right. Honestly, like, I think I would rather have that than like a fancy expensive bike that I would worry about getting stolen all the time.
Yeah. And $2,000, by the way, is low. Like, if you were to buy like a racing bike, like a road bike, you know, 10 speed is, you know, dated lingo or whatever, you can go up $10,000 easy on those. Like, it's not like watches, but it is like max. You can keep going and well yeah. into the five digits and just keep going and keep going. And it's insane. And also those, like, that's the type
five
of bike.
Five digits.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Holy, wow. I mean, I guess, yeah, once you start getting into like carbon fiber and stuff, I guess the sky's the limit, right?
And like Max, there's the premium above and beyond the, yes, this is made of fancy materials and engineering, but also we know that, you know, you're the pro users and you're actual racers, and yeah, it can get very expensive very fast.
Man, who knew?
It's better than a watch.
Actually, this people in the chat suggested the Schwinn Cruisers line. This actually looks pretty nice.
Yeah, they're like the same between thing. They look like Pee Wee Herman style, but they're just, you know, playing up the middle bikes, couple $100. I've never been on one, but I assume they pedal okay.
Available exclusively at Schwinn's signature independent bike shops.
Mm, yeah. Oh, wow. $800. I guessed too low.
Yeah, the high end ones are $800. The lower end ones are more like in the 4 to 5 range, but.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I don't know at what point in this price range pedaling becomes just like grinding a bunch of metal gears through sand. At what point does it become like, right. you know, sliding the bolt on a well-oiled rifle? That's the bike you want. You can borrow my Mongoose. It might be the right size. Actually, no, I would not let you borrow my Mongoose. Like, no, you wouldn't. Even though it was the best Christmas present I ever received, never would have received, it is still one of my prized possessions. So that's why I still have it.
I would not want to borrow your Mongoose because I'd be too afraid of damaging it.
Oh, yeah. I did a pretty good job on it. Like this is one of this tells you how different I was as a child and how it took me a long time to become the thing that you see before you today. At one point, I wanted to make sure that I had fear of my bike being stolen because the Mongoose and Red Lions were highly coveted in the neighborhood. And I wanted to make sure that I could identify my Mongoose. And the way my 9-year-old brain decided to do this was there was like a sticker on the front, like on the little tube that connects the handlebars down to the front fork, right? And there's a sticker on the front. I decided to take one of my dad's razor blades from like his little tool area and cut a big line down the middle of the sticker, like cut like a valley, and not even like a straight one, but it's like this big jagged, you know, as if you had taken something and just scraped the front of the thing. So like, now I can always identify my bike. And that's what I did. Does that sound insane to you? Like, what? No version of my brain as exists today would consider, like I literally damaged my own bike to identify it. And so down there it is down in the basement with a big giant gash there. And me looking at it and saying, what were you thinking, 9-year-old me?
Wow.
Oh, my word.
So now we just need to get Casey a bike and we'll be ready to go.
I wanted not the Mongoose Californian. I want to say it was the Huffy White Heat, which
Huffy's,
was like...
Huffy's crap.
I'm not saying it was good. I'm not saying it
I
was
love
good,
so
John.
Much. Oh, my God, I love
Huffy
that.
Is like
oh,
the wow. bottom of the... was the bottom of the neighborhood ladder. Because there was nothing below that. There was no like Walmart brand by Huffy. That was the bottom.
Oh, my God.
Are you done?
Mm-hmm. Just saying.
I don't even want to tell the story. I'm done.
Go ahead. Well, I got to Google this bike now. Is the Huffy what?
White Heat. I was looking for a picture earlier. I never found a terribly great one.
Oh, it auto-completed. It must be a popular bike.
I don't know. I think I wanted it because if memory serves, it had a pretty serious like marketing push. And I think it had like the little like guards in front of the handlebars, which I thought was super cool.
Yep, it totally did. It's a mountain bike, not a BMX bike.
Yeah. And it was like neon green, as you do in the late 80s, early 90s. I just wanted it so hard, and I eventually... Did I get it? I don't remember now.
Looks
you can tell
fancy.
How much it really...
I'm assuming it was still a crap bike because, you know, Huffy, but...
Sure it was.
Wow.
I mean, these days, Huffy is probably like a, you know, it's a name brand. It's above like the whatever the random Walmart brands are. So it actually probably the same quality as Mongoose and Redline these days. But when I was a kid, Huffy was, you just got a Huffy. It was a very materialistic go-go 80s money equals status environment for the single digit year old boys in suburban New York neighborhoods. 100%. Huffy's a funny name.
I'm looking at this cool Schwinn bike. The only thing is, it's like, I doubt I'm a 26 inch. I'm pretty sure that's like.
Do they have a bike store there near you?
There is a bike store in my town. It is not, whatever kind of dealer Schwinn says these are exclusively sold within, it is not showing up on their map.
Because you do want to. Well, you can probably fit a bike in your Tesla easy, but you want to do is ride it. Like, go to a bike store to buy it, first of all, even though you're going to pay way more, and then they'll let you ride it. Like, try it out, see how it feels, then you'll know which size, and you'll be able to distinguish the crap bikes from the good ones if you ride them back to back. It's well worth it.
Yeah, that is how I would do it, especially because I don't know what I'm doing. So, like, I would want the expertise of a local shop. Like, this is exactly what local shops are good at.
Yep.
Should I get a Mongoose Californian from 1984 for Adam's first bike?
Oh, that would be amazing.
If you could find one in good condition, and if he fits on the bike, yes, absolutely. It is
how old of a kid do you have to be to fit on it? Like, how
I think he's too. I think he's too small. He would have to be much bigger than he is. But like, if your kid was tall enough for it at the time that he wanted his first bike, yes, if you could find one. Because judging by the condition mine is in. I don't know if they're expensive to get in good condition, but yeah.
Let's see. Have you actually looked?
I have looked at them. I was looking for pictures of other people's. The problem is a lot of them, they seem to be modified a lot. It's like trying to find a 1990s Honda Civic with no modifications in good condition. It's like basically impossible.
I can get just the fork for $400. Yikes. There's one on eBay for $600. Oh my God. These are... much more than I expected.
It's a popular bike. The ones that have the plastic wheels, no. You want the ones with the wire spoke wheels. Like, those plastic wheels are either an option or aftermarket. And just say no to that. Let me find you a picture of my actual bike as close as I can find.
Yeah, it looks like the going rate for these is generally, looks like it's around $500. If you look like at eBay sold items.
That's probably close to what they're... Oh, look at this. Yeah. Every single one I find is modified. So this picture I'm going to put in the chat room now, it's close to mine. It has the... Mine does not have the bent back seat. My seat pole is straight. The stock seat poles were straight. And also those pedals are weird. But that is very, very close. And you can see the sticker I put the scratch in right in the little tube there. This is very close to... it's also probably in better condition than mine. But it's very close to mine.
You should do the scratch technique with your jet black iPhone.
Yeah, I always wonder what it looks like. Sometimes I forget I have a jet black phone because it's in the case, and I think about what it might look like under that. The best thing about the 84 Californian is, like Power Rangers, it came in colors. Black, red, blue, what was the other color? But anyway, it was, you know, you can see if you do a Google search for 1984 Mongoose California, you can see the red and the blue ones and the black ones. I got the black one, obviously, because it's the coolest.
Obviously.
But they were, like, the wheels on the red one were red, which was pretty cool. The wheels on the blue one were blue. Total Power Rangers vibe, and the colors looked awesome. They were like the candy colored IMAX before they were a thing. God, I at the point I would like to have, if I could get mint condition, I'm trying to think if there was a color other than red, blue, and black, but if I could get mint condition versions of all those with all the original stuff, like, that would be, that'd be right next to my LaFerrari and my fantasy unlimited money mansion.
Wait, if you could get a mint condition what now?
All three of these colors.
Oh.
Of these bikes.
What is a two-speed kickback drivetrain? What is that? Is that the one when you pedal backwards to brake?
I don't know. Never heard that term. Those newfangled technologies. I was a kid, bikes were simpler. They didn't have these weird... They have these things to make changing gear, you know, easier. Like, you just, like, making a binary, like, click this little wheel. When it clicks to the next number, you've changed gears. Whereas I come from the generation where you pull a lever that pulls a cord, and you have to pull it the right amount to get the thing onto the gear, right? So it was all, you know, a completely analog adjustment of knowing just where to put it. Now they try to make it mechanical. All these things have some sort of ratcheting mechanism where it's like, click, and it's exactly on the gear, or it's not. And there's nothing you can do about it.
So the people in the chat are saying that what this means is that you pedal backwards really hard to shift gears.
That's so it's terrible.
What?
It's a two-speed that you just, like, pedal backwards to shift between. So I guess it probably still has some kind of, like, you know, handle brake. Here, I'll place this link in the chat room. This bike, for some reason, has a built-in cup holder and bottle opener. Seems like a bad idea.
That's a high-performance machine right there. You know it's got a cup holder and bottle opener. Yeah, I guess it's a way. Maybe it's a way to have gears on a bike that doesn't have a derailleur. Like, it's... I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it seems like it probably just keeps like the handlebar area simpler. Like, you don't have, like, the big cables running up to do the gear shifting.
And it's also got, does that have some kind of suspension? That's a popular thing now for old people's delicate butts. Like, lots of bikes have suspension.
Yeah. You'd expect that.
I wouldn't expect that.
Well, I expect that. Excuse me.
Expect a cushion for your bum.
You say bum? You're one of those people?
No.
You're a bum person?
You know, it's like you're a posh cushion, so you got to say bum.
Yeah, see, the cool one I'm looking at here, this big classic one, this one has a Cruiser Springer fork. Does that mean it's like a little spring suspension in there? What does that mean?
Maybe. I mean, like I said, almost every bike for grown-ups has some form of suspension because grown-ups don't like going over the pothole-ridden infrastructure on our, you know, crumbling nation.
Yeah.
And realizing those shocks transfer directly through to you, it's unpleasant. Whereas as a kid, I don't remember being bothered by this at all. But as an adult, as a much heavier, larger adult, I can tell you it is jarring to have those jolts come through.
This one is totally awesome. If I can somehow try this in person somewhere, and if it actually fits me, I would seriously consider this.
Yeah, that's pretty styling. It's much, the other one was much more kind of like black and ugly. This looks like,
yeah, this one looks awesome. Like, and it has, this is like total, like, you know, 50s throwback. It has a built-in headlight and a horn.
You got to get a place to put, like, a basket so you can put, like, groceries and stuff in there.
it has the big back rack thing. Can you just, like, hang stuff off of that, right?
Yeah, well, you have, like, you can get panniers or something for the back on the sides of the wheels.
Is that what you call the little, like, side things on the...
Yeah, or you can just get a big, like, crate. You should ask the Portland people. They're all riding their bikes around with giant, like, they have these giant, like, wheelbarrows that you put your kids in that you push in front of your bike, and they're doing everything on bikes over there, which I don't understand because it isn't always raining there, but...
It is always running here or there. And also, so one of the reasons I don't have a bike here at home is because I live in a very hilly town, and biking on hills sucks. But
wimp.
At the beach, it's totally flat. Like, there's no hills. And because you're riding on sidewalks that are shared with people, you can't go that fast anyway.
You're riding the bike on the side? I guess there is no streets, right?
Yeah, they're like broadwalks. Like they're big,
they're
like
alleys.
Yeah, they're basically like double wide sidewalks. Those are the streets. But there's a lot of people around, like during peak weekends and stuff. So like you do have to be cautious of people. And you know, as you're walking, you hear like the bike bells behind you, ding ding, and you got to like move over. And yeah, so it's that kind of. But like, so I'm never going that fast, and I'm never going uphill. That's where I can get a ridiculous bike like a big cruiser like this, and it's not really impractical at all. With the exception of, you know, having to lock it up and not worry about getting stolen. So, but
the only thing I worry about with these bikes is because there are like 50 style bikes, like the reason they don't make bikes like this anymore is they're heavy. Like all that metal stuff for the guards to like, oh, so the rain doesn't splash back up and you're not going to be riding it in the rain. Like, oh, that everything about it, the metal cover for the chain and the big tube thing, like this is a heavy bike, and heavy bike equals harder to pedal, and, you know, like not good. That's why all the bikes, you want the bike to be light.
Actually, for my purposes here, I actually want, basically, I've been enjoying biking there for exercise and kind of sightseeing, but exercise is one of the primary goals, because I do a lot of dog walks, but, you know, my dog is fairly small, and he can only take so much, so, like, if I want to keep going with the exercise for the day, I gotta go out on a bike and get some more distance that way. But for my purposes, it's actually better if the bike is less efficient.
You're just saying that you didn't want to ride bikes where there were hills. So you got to make up your mind. Do you want exercise or do you not want exercise?
I want some exercise.
But not that much.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I think in the grand scheme of things, you want a bike that is efficient, that doesn't have a lot of friction losses, and that is not too heavy, because it is much more satisfying to ride an efficient bike for longer distances or faster than to ride a heavier bike for shorter distances. Like, it's the same amount of exercise work, but it feels worse to do the heavy bike for shorter distances.
That makes sense.
So you want to feel like, because the whole point of the bike is mechanically managed, like, look how fast I can go with just this much effort. If I put this much effort into walking, I'd be going slowly. Same amount of effort into a bike, and I'm flying, because going fast is fun, and the wind on you, and it's, you know, making the sweat evaporate and cooling you off. You want the efficient bike.
Fine.
And Tiff has to periscope this. Let's give her her assignment.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
What I really also want to periscope is I want to see you renting the sand bike and trying to make... I've never tried one of those things either. Like, I see them riding on the street. You can hear them coming from a mile away, like your M5, because the stupid tires, the giant knobby tires on the asphalt make this terrible droning noise.
Yep.
Right? But I've never seen one riding on sand, and I've never tried it, but it seems like it would be terrible.
Yeah, that's why... Yeah, I'm not in a huge rush to do that, because I suspect you're right. I suspect it will be just awful. So that's one of the reasons why, like, I've been going there a lot this summer, and I still haven't done it. I keep putting this off. I still haven't done it, so probably not going to. But
hey, see. Casey, here's what Huffy meant in my time. Take a look at that.
That's hideous.
That's a hell of a thing, huh? 1970s Huffy. Yikes. And that seat you see there, it's not a banana seat, because banana seats are for girls, or so we thought when we were stupid kids in the 70s. It's like a manly banana seat. See how much thicker it is?
It's a bronana seat.
Yeah. And I had before my Mongoose, I had basically an off-brand Huffy. It's like it wasn't even good enough to be a Huffy. It was like generic, terrible bicycle, and it had one of those seats on it. I hated it.
All right, I have a question. This bike I'm looking at, this big Schwinn 50s thing, it doesn't appear to have brakes in the
Does it have coaster brakes?
Yeah, it says brakes coaster. Yeah.
Coaster brakes are terrible. They're stupid. They're from the 50s, but that's what you're getting when you buy one of those.
Is that when you pedal backwards and it stops? What is
yes.
that?
Yes. Yep. You pedal backwards and it tries feebly to stop. There's a reason every real modern bike has handbrakes, because coaster brakes suck. But you're not going to be going fast, so you'll probably be fine.
Yeah. I'm going to look
at this. Just don't get up to speed going down a big long hill and think you're going to be able to jam on the brakes, because you won't, because coaster brakes suck.
But there are no hills.
And they only brake the back wheels. So all it's going to do, if you did ever start going fast and you tried to stop, all you do is, if you were able to with the coaster brakes, if you were even able to, is lock up the back wheel, and then your bike would continue to slide and slide and slide.
Yeah, I just spin out at that point.
No, you don't spin out. You continue to go the direction you were going. You just don't stop. It's like locking up. Imagine if you could just lock up the back wheels on a car. It would stop eventually, and you could still steer during that time, but you wouldn't stop as fast. So with the bike, you want to have front and back brakes that you were able to modulate so that you can stop faster. If you lock up both wheels, obviously you get double the friction, you stop even faster, but usually it doesn't come to that.
Have they not figured out analog brakes for bikes yet?
Those are analog. Yeah, you're pressing the levers. When I was out, I, rode my, this is the first time I've ridden my bike like amongst the cars in a long time, because normally you're riding it recreationally. Now I was riding to actually go somewhere. And I don't know if things have gotten worse since I was a kid, but people in cars want to kill people on bicycles. Like, I was using all of my defensive bicycle driving skills honed over many years of riding on like actual major highways before I had my license with my, you know, 10-speed bike and everything, just to stay alive. I was shocked at exactly how aggressively people in cars want to kill bicycles.
Yeah, I have zero temptation to ride a bike on roads. Like, up here in the suburbs, it would probably be less horrible, but I still don't think it would be great, because I feel like people, like, drivers really hate bikers. I don't know, like, I'm a driver, I don't care about bikers.
Or they're oblivious, even when there's bike lanes, yeah. They don't care there are bikes. Because we have actual painted on the ground bike lanes with little pictures of bicycles and dedicated lanes, and cars are like, this is my lane, bicycle, go away, I'm going to run you off the road with my giant Tesla Model X. It's like, save me, you know, like, it was scary.
So looking at the reviews of this bike, it's apparently 67 pounds.
That's a pretty heavy bike.
That seems like a lot.
It is a lot. It's made out of 50s metal, and they have metal places where you don't need it. Why does there need to be a metal chain guard? Why does there need to be a chain guard? Why? Because that's what they did in the 50s, because they were dumb. And all they had was metal left over from the war.
They can't, like, for this price, they can't throw in, like, some aluminum, maybe? Like, there are lighter metals.
I think it probably is aluminum. There's just so much of it. I mean, so that you need something structural, like structural steel or like very strong aluminum for the frame.
And then, but all the decoration pieces can be carbon fiber.
It's not though. It's metal, and it adds up. It maybe it's the whole thing is steel. That would explain 67 pounds. But yeah,
yeah.
Check out the weight for the Mongoose California. It is probably lower.
Well, yeah, because there's like no bike there practically.
25 pounds for the Californian.
So I can fit almost three of them in the weight of this bike, apparently.
Oh my goodness.
It does have excellent reviews. The reviewers all say basically what you'd expect. It's like, this is an awesome bike. It's beautiful. It's smooth. It looks awesome. You know, it's great. It's fun to ride. However, it's heavy and the brake is not sufficient enough for its weight.
Mm-hmm. Coaster brake.
So everything you'd expect.
Oh, now I'm on eBay looking at these bikes. This is not good.
I told you, yeah. But yeah, it looks like they go, it seems like they go in pretty reasonable quantity. Because if you look at sold items, there's a good number of them there. And they seem to be approximately $500 range.
For non-original, like, they're not even, I can look at them, I can say these are not original part, all sorts of aftermarket stuff, and still $500. There's lots of people with fond memories of this bike, I think. People my age with money they want to spend. Chromoly. That's what the frame is made out of. What is chromoly? The world may never know.
Yeah, I've never even heard of that.
That was its big selling point in the 80s, like blast processing.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Discussed amongst the kids in like the lunchroom, chromoly was discussed.
Oh my goodness.
Does your bike have chromoly? No.
It's a chromoly frame. Well, the chrome part of it you can get because it's shiny. Like, the outside looks like it's shiny and chrome. What was it made about? I'm assuming it was some sort of aluminum thing or whatever, but blast processing and chromoly. That's it.